Finance. And to my wife, all the members of the provincial delegation that are here.
That at this point in time transfers and how one then moves from the transfers as allocations, and then you go to the budget and then assess the report on how those allocations have been utilized. So I've brought a team of people from different functional areas of the Commission's work. I've got on my far left Conrad van Haas. He is one of the senior managers in the budget analysis unit. And then I've got on my left, immediate left, is Vincent McKinter. He is a senior manager responsible for intergovernmental fiscal relations. I've got on my right, Lydia Tenga. She is also a senior manager in the budget analysis unit. Next to her is Jugal Mahabir. He is working as a researcher in the local government unit. And next to him is Donald Sibanda, who is our data and information analyst. And then sitting over there to make the first presentation is Eddie Rakabe. He is a senior researcher in the fiscal policy unit and works mainly with the provincial transfers and provincial taxes and all of that.
And there at the back, two persons are sitting there doing oversight of what we are doing. Can they please introduce themselves? A very important delegation.
Good morning to the committee. Good morning, Chair. Thank you. My name is, I'm not sure about the oversight in terms of what the committee does. But my name is Tulenda Gantana from the Intergovernmental Relations Branch in the National Treasury Provincial Budget Analysis.
Good morning. My name is Edgar Fishi, also from Intergovernmental Relations in the National Treasury.
Welcome to you as well. You may continue.
Because we've lost so much time, I think we're just going to have to go straight into Eddie Rakabe's presentation. I think, Eddie, you should just go straight into the key issues. Eddie is going to deal with just a brief background on the FFC, but he's going to deal with the provincial equitable share formula and where we are at with the review of the provincial equitable share formula. Trying to distribute.
Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you very much. My deputy commissioner already introduced a brief background. Okay. I'm going to be doing a presentation basically on the role of the Financial, Fiscal and Fiscal Commission and a presentation on the provincial equitable share formula. We've tried to make a presentation as simple as possible, and so I hope that what people do not understand good. Questions. Firstly, just a brief outline of what I'm going to be presenting about, the background on the Financial and Fiscal Commission and the constitutional imperative of the provincial equitable share formula, the institutional framework within which the provincial equitable share formula functions. Yes. I'm going to be covering also a bit of a background about the economic rationale and the historical background of the equitable share formula, just to give people an understanding of where this formula comes from. And then from there, we'll look at the current structure of the formula, how it operates, and the current review which the formula is currently undergoing, as well as the current thinking within the FFC and our stakeholders. Firstly, as we all know, the Financial and Fiscal Commission is established in terms of the Constitution and also through the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act in a a nutshell, the role and functions of the and the powers of the commission are determined by the constitution, as I already said. And as per the constitution, the commission must report to both the national and the provincial legislature. I think the Intergovernmental Relations Fiscal Act also requires the SFC to be consulted on numerous fiscal issues, especially in relation when there are legislations being passed which have got fiscal implications to both provinces and municipalities. I think the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act, as well as the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act, requires that the commission should be consulted. And on an annual basis, the commission makes recommendations on the division of revenue between and among the three spheres of government, as well as any conditional and unconditional products. Well, I think the problem is with the machine. Okay.
Members, you will have to follow on the hard copy as well. So yes. There's a disturbance there.
The problem is the machine is not properly set. Like I pointed out, the key legislation that underpins the equitable share of the division of revenue between and among the three spheres of government is the Constitution, and Section 217 entitles both provinces and municipalities to a share to an equitable share of nationally raised revenue. And the reason why, of course, that is made is because, provinces have got a narrow base taxes, and yet they've got quite extensive spending responsibilities. But again, if you look at between provinces and municipalities, you would also realize that there's actually vast variation in fiscal capacity. Basically, what this means is that the different provinces and municipalities also have got varying capacity to collect or to generate revenue. And therefore, the constitution make provision for an equitable sharing of the taxes which are raised nationally. But the important point that we need to put here is that the Constitution itself does not prescribe the methodology for determining each province or municipality's share of nationally raised revenue. It only lists sectors which need to be considered in making such a determination. And the section that is very relevant in this case is Section 214A to J, which stipulate that in making allocations between the different spheres of government, these factors need to be taken into account: national interest, the national debt, the needs and interest of the national ability to perform the functions to perform the functions by both the provinces and municipalities, the developmental needs, the economic disparities, and all those other sectors listed here. And the question that may come here is one may ask himself as to how does the formula take all of these sectors into account. Obviously, some of these sectors, there's a lot of trade-offs between all of these sectors, so it's not easy for the formula, for the provincial equitable share formula and the local government equitable share formula to take all of these into account. But where is feasible, the issue of economic disparities, we've got a methodology of dealing with that. I don't know what's wrong with this machine. It looks like it's just stuck. again, what we need to note is that the equitable share itself, not necessarily the profit, the equitable share formula, but the pool itself, it operates within a certain institutional framework, and that institutional framework is made up of various institutions like the National Treasury, the Budget Council, the Budget Forum, the other miscellaneous intergovernmental fiscal forums such as your 10x10 and the Financial of Fiscal Commission, and of course, most importantly, Parliament. As the FFC interacts with various stakeholders throughout the national budget process, through our working cycles, as I already mentioned, through an Act of Parliament, the equitable division of revenue, of national rates revenue, may only be enacted once the FFC has been consulted. So this is just a brief background of what our model is based on. So we've got quite a legislative guidelines and institutional framework within which the models are based on. Just quickly on why we need intergovernmental fiscal transfers or grants itself economically. As I've already said, that grants are actually a dominant source of subnational governments, especially if you think about provinces. They are actually up to 97% dependent on national transfers. And certain municipalities, you'd find that they can depend on transfers up to about 100%. So these are very important source of revenue for sub-national government. And they're actually very important for the fiscal health of provinces, but not only that, to facilitate, to make sure that services delivery to facilitate service delivery within both provinces and municipalities. The key rationale, I think, for equitable share is another economic rationale. It's basically for redistributive purposes. As we all know, there's a very big vertical gap. Vertical gap simply means that the ability to raise revenue between the three spheres of government is not equal. According to the constitution, assigned more revenue-raising powers to national government. So this leaves municipalities and provinces with less revenue-raising powers. Municipalities have got property rates, but provinces only have very, very, very meagre sources of revenue, such as your casino taxes, which doesn't really make a lot of revenue. So from that sense, there's a very big vertical gap, and that's why you need to make sure that provinces are also able to deliver constitutional mandated services. This graph basically just shows the extent of tax assignment between provinces, between national government, provinces, and municipalities. As you see, the most buoyant tax sources are actually assigned to national government, like your income taxes, corporate taxes, VAT, fuel levy, and customs duties. Provinces have got they are assigned motor vehicle licenses, gambling taxes, and hospital fees. And these revenue sources, on aggregate, generate up between 3 and 7% of total provincial revenue. With respect to municipalities, the most dominant revenue sources are your user charges on things like electricity, water, as well as property rates. And these revenue sources can generate from between 10% and 90%, depending on the type of municipality. If it's a metro, you'd find that the sources actually generate quite a lot of revenue. But if you go to your smaller rural municipalities, there's actually very little that municipalities are able to collect through these sources, because of obviously the importance of low economic activity and the high rate of poverty level. And just lastly, on the economic rationale, and the especially, which is very important for our equitable share discussion that will follow in the next few slides, it's that we need grants to deal with the horizontal gap. If you look at the little pie chart on the left of your presentation slide, you would see that if you look at Gauteng actually generates up to about 33% of total GDP. So this, in simple terms, just shows you that if Gauteng was assigned tax sources like your VAT and income taxes, it would actually be generating more money than all these other provinces than say Northern Cape, for example, which only generates at least about 8.1% so you need the equitable share mechanism to normalize that kind of inequity that are entrenched in the economic system of our country. But another more important reason could actually for fiscal harmonization or equalization, to ensure that if a citizen in Gauteng get similar kind of services that a citizen in Limpopo would ordinarily get. So these are your key reasons why we need this grant system. And some of these reasons we try to incorporate them in our formula so that it reflects the peculiar circumstances of different provinces and municipalities. Going to different categories of grants, we've got broadly grants are classified into two. You've got your unconditional grants and conditional grants. Basically, the equitable share would fall under unconditional grants, but within unconditional grants, you'll also have what you call non-matching grants as well as block grants. Conditional grants can further be classified into matching grants, which are your Schedule 5 kind of grants as well as non-matching grants. Just a point here to make is that the provincial equitable share formula as well as the local government equitable share formula is both an unconditional and non-matching grant. And another point to raise here is that in South Africa currently we don't have a so-called matching grant, although in certain circumstances you'd find that people refer to the IG, what you call the infrastructure grant to provinces as a matching grant. So, but I mean, the point we're just making here is that there is no such a grant currently in South Africa. Coming to methodology and closer to the mechanism that is used for calculating the equitable share between provinces, we look at different methodologies for distributing grants between the various spheres of government. There are numerous methodologies for allocating transfers between provinces and municipalities. You can use ad hoc mechanism, which I think it was used up until 1998 in South Africa when we used to have functions committees and stuff. You can also use the origin of collection, which simply means that you collect money. The money is redirected to a province, to a location from which it was generated. You can also have cost reinvestment grant system, which simply means that provinces or municipalities are reinvest for the cost they incurred in performing certain functions. You also have performance-based methodologies, which can be partial performance-based methodology, which means that province or a municipality is rewarded for performing certain agreed deliverables. And lastly, you can also use a formula-based methodology for allocating. And this is, I think, it's more, the formula-based methodology is more objective because it's not susceptible to manipulation by different by different stakeholders with narrow interest or. Any transfer system obviously needs to adhere to certain principles of good transfer of a good transfer system, and I think I've already touched a bit on this when I was talking about the A to J principles of the constitution. But in addition to that, I think in a nutshell, what we want to just share with you guys, with you here, is that the transfer system obviously must respect the autonomy of each sphere of government, especially with regard to priorities between national and there's always a conflict there, but a good transfer system or a transfer methodology should at least respect that. It must also be adequate. It must also enhance equity, meaning that it must deal with all provinces of municipality in an equitable manner. It must be predictable, and currently we've got an MTF budget for a process which I think does better in terms of predictability. It must be simple. It should not be complicated for people to understand. It must also provide some few incentives. The question now is does our formulas or methodologies comply with all of these sectors? Like I said before, it's not easy for the formula to comply with all of these sectors, but where possible, the calculation mechanism tries to incorporate some of these sectors into account. Quickly moving to the equitable share formula itself, and in this case I'm dealing specifically with the provincial equitable share formula. As I said, the provincial equitable share formula is basically a transfer mechanism that distributes funds among the 9 provinces. It is underpinned by the constitution. It was introduced in 1998 following the realization that the function committee were a bit inevitable in the manner in which it was allocating funds across various provinces. The formula here, it's component-based and it's population-driven. Basically, what does this mean is that the formula comprises of various components that reflect the functions of the provinces. So it will have education, health, and the key drivers that drive the equitable shares are basically the population. So here you can think of the number of school-going children, the number of people who don't have medical aid, but we'll look into that in the next few slides. Obviously, the formula is not perfect. It's always subjected to several reviews. Since inception, it has gone through a number of reviews in an effort to try to make it more simpler and to comply with some of those principles that we've already talked about. Just to note where the current formula comes from. In 1996, the Financial and Fiscal Commission made a recommendation for a formula-based approach to the division of revenue. You would note that already I've spoken about the various mechanisms for allocating, for distributing funds across provinces. And in 1996, following the FFC's assessment of all this, the advantages and disadvantages of all these various mechanisms, we came to the conclusion that a formula-based approach was more the formula-based approach was actually better than all these other. At inception, the formula comprised of 7 components. Each component uses certain variables as need indicators, and is weighted equally across all provinces. The formula had the education component, which had a weighting of 40%, meaning that if say for example there's 100 billion for provinces, a total equitable share pool of 100 billion, 40% in the formula, not necessarily how it's distributed within the provinces, would be allocated for education. It had also had the health component, which had a weighting of 18%, the social security component, an economic activity component, the backlogs component, as well as the basic and institutional component. All of these components combined, they make 100%. So if you calculate, if you add all the weightings attached to each component, you would get 100%. Like I said, the formula has undergone several reviews. In 2001, the backlog component was taken out because of the introduction of the provincial infrastructure grant. Now infrastructure provinces infrastructure grant to provinces. In 2004, again, the social security component was taken out because of the introduction of SASA, which was taking over the social security function to the national government. In 2006, again, there was a demarcation process that led to the review of the equitable share formula, because there was a lot of people moving from one province to another, so there was a need for an equitable share formula. And again, on an annual basis, the equitable share formula goes through an update of data, which is basically your the number of people between provinces, and taking into consideration that people on an annual basis move across provinces. Currently, this is how the formula works. It's got 6 components, but now the education component no longer has 40% weighting, but it constitutes about 51%. And the key indicators in the education component are learner enrollment and school age population. Also, we still have the health component, which mainly comprises of people with and without medical aid. But now the health component is now weighted at about 26% from 18% in 1998. We've got the basic component, which has been increased from 9 to 14%. The institutional component remains at 5%. And now we also have the poverty component, which was introduced in 2004 following the removal of the social security component, as there was an issue that the removal of the social security component was disadvantaging poorer provinces, because there was a lot of poor provinces used to get a lot of money from the social security component. So when that was removed, there was a contention that actually disadvantaged provinces, so that triggered the introduction of the poverty component, although it is very much lower weighting of 3%. And the indicators in that component are proportion of poor people who are in quintile 1 and quintile 2. So these are the most people who are considered to be poor. And lastly, we've got the economic activity component, which we use the regional GDP as indicator. And in this component, you'll realize that housing obviously would have a bigger share of them. But the good thing is it's actually weighted at 1%. So even if housing has got a bigger share of economic activity, it does not necessarily mean that housing gets a lot of money because of that. Just a quick look on how the total provincial equitable share pool is determined. Provincial equitable share pool is determined. It's obviously the national, it's a vertical revenue sharing process, which is quite political in nature, but also go through a number of administrative processes in which departments do biddings and all the stuff. But ultimately what comes out is that national government would have their own share of the total national budget, which is about this is just an indication, it's not the current year budget, so the numbers have not been updated for this current year budget. But just to give an indication is that national government would have about 49.5%, provinces would take 43% of the total national budget, and local government would take about 7.6%. These percentages do not really, although the numbers are changing, but the percentage do not necessarily changes that much. So they remain fairly constant over time. The provinces' provincial equitable share pool is therefore divided into further two categories, which is the provincial equitable share and the conditional grant. In this case, 200 billion would go to provincial equitable share, and 38 billion would go to conditional grant. And this 200 billion rand is the one that will be divided through the equitable share formula. And this is how the formula works. I don't know how else to put this in a very simple way, but the formula is actually it's a deterministic model, meaning that the outcomes are determined through known relationships. So it's unlike your other econometric model where certain variables you are unaccounted for. So you know that the outcomes that come from the equitable share are as a result of the things that of the inputs that you put in the model. So there is no way that the person can complain that he doesn't know how his total share ultimately comes from. And this is just a mathematical specification of the formula, simply showing that the equitable share for a given province will be made of a combination of the education share, the health share, the basic share, the poverty share, the economic activity share, and the institutional component share. And in a nutshell, this is how the formula works. If we take the education component, for example, the education component will be made of the school enrollment, number of school enrollment, and the age cohort, which is actually the school going age population of between 5 and 17%. So if you take Eastern Cape, for example, to calculate their shares, you take about 2 million kids enrolled, and about 2.1 million of school going age population. So what you simply do that is you take a share of Eastern Cape to the total school enrollment, and that will give you a 17.2% share. And you do the same with the age cohort, which is basically the share of Eastern Cape to the total national school going population, which gives you 6.6%. And when you average that out, you got 16.9%, which is reflected on the left side column of your presentation slide. who is relative to those that do not have medical aid, such that more money would go to those to provinces where there are more people without medical aid. And the calculation mechanism is simply the same all across. You just take, if you want to calculate the share of Eastern Cape, you just take Eastern Cape has got about 713 people with medical aid, and then as a percentage of total, that accounts to about 25%. And when you weight that all out, you ultimately end up with 14.9%. So with all the other provinces, you do the same. Basic component, basically here is just the share of each province population. Eastern Cape is about 6 million people. As a percentage of total population of about 48 million, Eastern Cape has a share of above 13.5%. So this is just simple proposal. The basic component, as I said, you use a number of population of poor people in quintile 1 and in quintile 2, as well as the basic component value, which is just the number of the people of the people per province. So the calculation mechanism is the same all across in the institutional component. In the institutional component, I think the only difference here is that all provinces are weighted equally on the assumption that the administrative cost of running government does not necessarily differ per province. But I mean that is actually agreeable, because if you think about Northern Cape, where there's a vast distance, so the cost of running government is a bit high. So that's one of the reasons why the equitable share is currently being under review to look into this problem. You've got the economic activity component. This is, again, here is just the share of the contribution of the provincial contribution to GDP relative to the national, to the total national GDP. To get the total share, ultimately what you do is to add the per province. You combine all the individual component shares to get the total weighted average share. So in this case, for Eastern Cape, you'll take the total education share of 16.9 and the total health share of 14.9. You add again with the total basic share, poverty share, the economic activity share, and you weigh all of that to 100%, and you ultimately end up with 15.6% for Eastern Cape. So the calculation mechanism for all the provinces is basically the same. So no province is treated with any favoritism or and all the data that is used in the formula is independently collected, such that no provinces can influence the outcome of the shares generated by the model. So we get the data from Statistics SA, put it in the model, and calculate and simply generate the shares. In certain years, when the formula goes through annual data updates, you find that it throws out mystery results, in the sense that there has been quite population movement across provinces, and when that happens, when you update the formula, it suddenly changes the shares in such a manner that, in such a way that certain provinces lose money and others gain quite substantially. So to normalize that, we usually phase in the shares over a 3-year period, over an MTEP period, such that you minimize the shock that other provinces would ordinarily have got because of sudden shifts in population. For example, in this case, I think that there was a very big shift in when this year the formula was updated. There was a big shift in Eastern Cape, in population share, especially I think it was because of school enrollment and school age population. So there was a big shift a big jump. It might not look very big when you look at it in percentage terms, but in terms of money, it makes a very big difference. So over time, the phasing in make sure that you smooth out the shock that would have been brought out by, and most of the time when this phasing in is done, it's only done when the data changes are because of uncontrolled the things that are out of our control. If you take demarcation, for example, it has also resulted in this kind of shock, especially for Northwest. It received quite a knock because of the people shifting from Northwest to Gauteng. But because that was a kind of a human intervention, there was a decision not to fade in the formula, because otherwise you delay the knock-on effect on the formula. It takes time for the formula to reflect the real situation, unlike in this case where it's just a result of data sheets which are not influenced by anyone. My slide up. This thing is stuck. But you can follow the. This is just a simple example of how you ultimately end up with the share for each province. If you take Eastern Cape, for example, as like I've already indicated, you will take the Eastern Cape share of education component multiplied by 51%, that is the total education share, plus health component multiplied by 26% with the total health share, the total health component, and so on and so on, and ultimately you end up with the ultimately you end up with 15.6% as a share of total of Eastern Cape, and when you calculate the Eastern Cape, how much does Eastern Cape then get? If the total equitable share pool is 200 billion, then you take 200 billion, multiply by 15.6%, and you get plus minus 30 billion. So you do the same with other provinces, and we get the. So it's a fairly transparent, and a simple way of calculating the share. But somebody might ask whether the formula can be manipulated to give more money to any provinces. The question is simply no. The formula, it treats each province equally by using data which is independently collected, as I've already spoken, and this eliminates possibilities of manipulation. If any need for more funding is required, and I think that it's done through the vertical division, the vertical revenue sharing process as well. Bidding process take place. Well, that's just how in a nutshell how the formula works. And from where somebody sit might actually think that the formula is actually working perfectly, because it's generating shares and it's not manipulated. It can't be manipulated. And you might ask yourself, why do you need to review the formula? Why do they need to constantly review the formula? Well, as I said, that there are certain principles that a formula must adhere to, and it's impossible to take all of those into account. So every now and then, you'd have people complaining that the formula is not taking that into account, is not addressing this, is not addressing that. So that's why the formula now currently is undergoing review. And as the FFC were requested at some point to lead the review process, and what part of the key reasons that prompted the review was actually the removal of the social welfare component in 2004. And that resulted in misalignment between weightings and provincial spending. And what this means basically is that certain provinces were spending far above what the formula prescribed, weightings are not necessarily budget guidelines, but when the money was taken out of the equitable share formula, it was found that certain provinces were spending far above the money that had been taken out to deal with the Social Security Agency, and that caused a lot of misalignment. And the formula again was challenged primarily from poorer provinces like Limpopo and Eastern Cape, that it has lost its redistributiveness power. In other words, it's no longer giving more money to the, so to speak, your poorer provinces. And again, there was an issue about the arbitrary determination of the weighting. In other words, on what basis do we say that the education share should get 51% as opposed to roads getting 7% or something like that? So those were some of the reasons that prompted the need for a review. Just to note here that the review was actually driven by the inputs that were received from provinces, and what the key, very stark issue that came out from the inputs that the FFC made, got from the province was about channeling of resources to poorer provinces. So there is the issue that I've pointed out about Eastern Cape and Limpopo. There was an issue again about the incorporation of the social welfare component. This is different from the social security component. Social security component deals with grants, but there's a social welfare function that provinces still perform, and that is not reflected in the formula. So there was a concern that should also be taken into account in the formula. The issue of the economic disparities between provinces, there was a feeling that the formula in its current state does not address this adequately. Exploring new indicators for the formula, again, there is an issue that most probably learner enrollment if you take education, for example, learner enrollment and school age population are not necessarily the appropriate indicators of education needs within a province. And so those do not reflect adequately the education needs of a province. So there was a concern that maybe we have to explore other need indicators that could best reflect education needs within the province. Again, there is also a very thorny issue about the balancing of discretion between national and provincial policy. This is a very philosophical debate that we always have about whether national priorities should be preferred over provincial priorities. So there was also that issue that was raised. Again, there was an issue that we must find alternative to demographically driven formula. So, in other words, instead of using the population, maybe we should think about using the kilometers of growth as indicators of needs within provinces. So, and then again, there was an issue about the need to assess the feasibility of the costed norms, which is a formula-based another formula-based mechanism that the FFC has proposed some years ago, which was could not be implemented because of data complications and data shortages and some understanding within certain circles about how the formula was supposed to have worked. Following the review, the FFC has actually in the last round of the annual submission has actually made recommendations of the provincial equitable share formula. largely on the work that we have done and certain simulations that we have performed on the provincial equitable share formula, and we also made certain alternative formula mechanisms that can be used in the future. Unfortunately, because of the machine here, I don't think we'll be able to reflect that. But the key points that came out from the review was that we are trying to address too many objectives with the formula. We overload the provincial equitable share formula with too many policy objectives. So, in other words, we want to achieve quite a lot of things with a transferring mechanism. So, and then there was also a question about, we also find that there's not really clarity about whose priorities should be funded through the equitable share formula. That is also a debate about provinces and national. There was again what we noted, there was a kind of misunderstanding about the basic nature of the provincial equitable share formula. In other words, whether the equitable share formula is an unconditional grant or a general purpose grant. Currently the way the intergovernmental fiscal system operates is that there are certain practices that are institutionalized, especially through national treasury, where they obviously through the national treasury and the national departments of education and health, they would want to see the money that they bid for reflected in the provincial budget, and when that does not happen, it creates kind of a conflict between national government and provinces. So that is what we also found out in the review. But at the end of the day, we actually find that the complaints about the redistributiveness nature of the formula were a bit unfair, because the formula actually, as it stands, it directs quite a lot of money to poorer provinces in relative terms. So, and the conclusion we came to was that the problem lies with other pillars of the fiscal decentralization system. And what does that mean is that there is an issue, again, which is more not related to the equitable share formula, but it affects how the provincial equitable share formula is perceived, which is the issue of expenditure assignment, the matching of allocation to agreed priorities, the methodology for quantifying expenditure needs. So, like I said, that there's a concern that the way in which we quantify expenditure is within the equitable share formula. It's considered inadequate, and therefore we need to find alternative. And again, there's an issue about clarity on the nature of decentralized expenditure responsibility, the issue of revenue autonomy, which are all very bigger than the equitable share itself, and frankly require more higher level intervention than, and cannot be dealt within the equitable share formula. But as we got from the review was that people wanted the equitable share itself to deal with all of these problems, and that's why we said it's overloaded with too many policy objectives which have got nothing to do with the sharing of revenue, but the other pillars of the decentralization system. We also noted some weaknesses with the conditional grants and the borrowing system. And ultimately, we made, as the FFC, we made some alternative options for reforming the equitable share. As I said, we also made some simulation by developing some models, but because of the machine here, we won't be able to show that. So lastly, just to show the last two slides on the options of the reform that we've made, was that the provincial equitable share formula existence must be refined within the confines of the current system. So what you need to do is to address the problems of the PF, not related to your expenditure assignments and matching allocations, but look at more the issues of methodology for quantifying expenditure needs, which I think are more relevant to the equitable share formula. Improve its performance to improve the performance of the provincial equitable share formula in terms of the provincial policy we've already spoken about, and what we envisaged was that the provincial equitable share will retain most of its current structure, but we bring it to it closer to what we call an equalization grant, meaning that you calculate the expenditure needs, which is quite a very rigorous exercise, and also calculate the fiscal capacity, which is the ability of each province to collect revenue, and the difference between the two will be compensated through what we refer to as the equalization fund. And what we also proposed was that we divide the pool into sub-pools in line with objectives. We're also proposing that the economic activity component must be taken out of the formula, because it's more like a revenue sharing mechanism, so it must be taken out to reflect the objective of that of its key objective, which is about revenue sharing rather than just so that you simplify the formula even further.
Second option, which is about reforming
other pillars of the fiscal system, establishing clear links between instruments and objectives, strengthening the overall governance of the basic social delivery. And here, that's why we propose that there probably should be a block grant to deal with education and health, as they are both the key functions of the provinces. So essentially, a block grant would mean that money, say for example, if we take 51% as the education money, as the education allocation from the equitable share formula, that money would only be used for education, will only be allocated for education. In other words, provinces cannot shift that money from education to other functions. But what essentially means that they would only have flexibility to shift funds within the education, but not across other functions of the other provinces. So that's basically what a block grant is. So you do the same with health component. And this what we propose this in light of the fact that there is this contention on making allocations to propose priorities by the national government and provinces. So that was a way in which we thought it could actually minimize this kind of problem. Yeah, I think that's where my presentation will end. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to recap now the slide number, because we couldn't.
Yes.
37.
Yes.
That's the one that's on the screen.
Yeah. But I ended off on slide number 39.
Because Limpopo is composed of the Gazankulu, the Vuwa, RSS, then was the study done? Because if you demarcate Pulukwane, you'll find that part of Pulukwane, which was paying the services, falls under the former, what I believe, sometimes under Gazankulu. Was the study conducted in order to remedy this type of cancer? Because the cancer will remain if the study was not conducted. In order to educate, why making the research is to go down deep to educate this other part, which was sometimes former Gazankulu, former one, in order to have the culture of paying services. Was the study conducted? If not, why? If it is conducted, was the monitoring being done in order to keep them on par? Thanks.
Well, Charlie?
Thanks, Chair. My first question would be, at what stage does the FFC get involved in the processes of budgeting, and particularly on the division of revenue? And second question, I would just want you to explain, and if need be, give examples of what is a matching and a non-matching grant. And my last question would be, do provinces follow the same formula in distributing or allocating their own revenue to their own departments? And if so, to what extent are they compliant with those guidelines as presented in this particular slide number 20, I think. And the last question, very last one, Honorable Mashile. Your slide 22. Those figures that you have given there, are they just examples or are they real figures of people with the number of people in a particular province with medical aid versus those without medical aid? Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Mashile.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'm having a little bit of interest on the fiscal gap and the so-called equalization grant. I just want to know how will this formula assist to generate activity where the poor provinces have got less fiscal capacity. Because if we just simply stick to the gap on their expenditure as well, as compared to what they can generate, the formula will be just sustaining the status quo. And whereas then we should be trying to move towards where provinces can be self-sustaining. The next question is the view that the division or the provision of equitable shares to provinces where it's not prescribed. In other words, what I'm understanding is that provinces then can do as they please with what has been allocated to them. Now, given the situation where allocation is made to provinces relative to its equitable share on health, but then the province utilize the funds for other things, and you find that at the end of the day, for health, they have actually utilized 30%. Is that not actually negating national priorities? And how do we ensure then, if we are not prescriptive, being an unconditional grant, how do we then ensure that national priorities are carried through the provinces? 70%.
Any other questions? Not. May I reply?
Okay. Let me respond to the kind of general questions, and then I'll ask Eddie to respond to specific questions that come from his presentation. The first one, I think, Honorable Makubela, you basically asking whether there were any studies done before we actually arrived at the kind of boundaries that we have, because at the end of the day you have some poor provinces, there is a tradition of this and that because of the homeland system and all of that, so you combined all of this into one. Now, from our perspective, we would want to assume that the demarcation board basically did those kinds of exercises. They might not have been very comprehensive at that point when the first boundaries were drawn. I think in terms of data that one had to work with, there was very little information. And so the re-demarcation processes and the reviews that are actually currently taking place are basically in response partly to some of those kinds of problems that are yeah, so I think there was an objective process followed, and there were deliberate attempts, because if you look at, I think in Eddie's presentation, he basically spoke about the first formula that had a specific component to try and, that was meant to try and deal with backlogs. And up until 2001, that component was in existence. It was actually done away with around about 2001-2002 when we introduced the infrastructure grant for profit. Now, that backlog component was meant to try and fast-track those poor provinces. In fact, the early discussions were about a rural component, but there was no way to measure ruralness. So that is something that was there, except that probably in terms of the data, that was the extent of that poverty might not have been adequately captured. But certainly now there is more information and people are actually aware that there is this, and the kind of conditional grants that we have must of necessity be designed in such a way that they target and try and deal with those kinds of issues. The second one, which I think is a general question, relates to the stage at which the FFC gets involved in the budget process. I think the FFC basically is involved in the budget process from the beginning. Firstly, when we table the recommendations, in fact, we basically tabling our recommendations in May, at the end of April, we're tabling our recommendations for the Division of Revenue for 2007. Now, that process basically requires that we interact with the National Treasury, who are the key drivers of the budget process. So every step of the way, they have a Division of Revenue workshop, they have a strategic planning exercise with the Technical Committee of Finance. The FFC is part and parcel of that. We might not be very directly involved in the actual decision, but in terms of the process and the principles, we are certainly part and parcel of the process. The next one, which is not a technical one, it's the question from Honorable Mashile that basically deals with matching provincial equitable share allocations to national priorities. I think that is a very complicated exercise, because at some point in the past 2 years, when we've been trying to look at what the key problems were, with certainly there's been quite a lot of discomfort with outcomes when one gets to the provincial level after allocations are determined through the division of revenue process and all of that, when provinces must then go and budget. You then find that at a national level, you know, some, let's say the Minister of Education, for example, feels that insufficient money has been allocated in certain provinces for education. Now, on the basis of the discussions that would have taken place during the division of revenue process, they would have expected a certain outcome. And when that does not happen, then there's a disjuncture between what would have been a national priority against what a provincial priority is. And one would expect that such should actually be an expected outcome, because there's a government which has got executive authority to take certain decisions at that level. That in principle. But the other principle that guides the division of revenue process is that cooperative governance, where we must deal with this thing cooperatively amongst the three spheres. And therefore, whatever is agreed that way must actually of necessity show. Even though the equitable share is non-conditional, there are certain imperatives that the Constitution imposes. For example, it does specify what the equitable share is meant for. So the Constitution does specify that, even though it's non-conditional. Now, I would basically be quite happy if Julinda had the fact, because that's one of the key issues that she actually deals with every time these things must come up. She must then look at what the budgets look like. And she might actually have a view, or she can actually clarify what the actual discussion around this is, matching national priorities and ensuring that at the provincial level those are actually reflected. It's quite a big issue, because at the provincial level there are some who feel that national might be interfering with executive authority of a provincial government to take decisions on its budget. And that's an issue. I'm sure Julinda might have something to say about that. I think Eddie, you can then deal with the issue around the matching and non-matching grants, and also there are certain. Yeah, please.
Okay. Well, the difference between a matching and non-matching grant would be that in a matching grant, say, a national government would say to a province, for every rand you spend on infrastructure, I'll put another rand. And a non-matching grant would just be the opposite, where it's just an unconditional allocation. So that's basically the simplistic difference. Do the provinces follow formula? Well, the equitable share formula only, its function is just to distribute funds across provinces. Once it gets to a provincial level, it's then the function of the provincial executive to allocate funds within the respective. So there is no guideline or any form of formula that is used to make allocations at that level. It's basically a function of the executive. But again, there is also the issue of priorities that the deputy chairperson of the commission has just spoken about. That in making such allocations, they need to take into consideration the priorities that have been set by national government. So there is basically no guideline or any kind of formula. Again, it's just simply an executive decision taken at that level. The question of whether the figures are real in slide 22, yes, the figures are taken as is from Statistics South Africa. So those are the real figures, real-life figures from Statistics South Africa.
All these are figures?
Uh-huh.
I have to comment there. I think the issue was where you see 2001 census and the population, which shows the 1998, then the 2008 allocation. What we have there is the explanation that says that for the education component, the figures are old, like 2001, that's more than 10 years old. But the reason why you're using those figures is the issue under education where the principals are reporting the number of learners they have in schools. And then therefore, to make sure that the principals do not over-report on the number of learners because they know that they will benefit as a province in terms of the allocation, you use the census 2001, which was the full census of the number of people in provinces, in municipalities, in households, to make sure that you normalize the populations in provinces. Now, in one instance, Gauteng would over-project the number of learners they have, which would go beyond the age band. Then, therefore, until such time when the next answer, you are not going to be able to control the over-reporting in provinces. Now, if you allow it to go ahead, one province would lose because one province over-reported. Then, therefore, that's why the weighting is one-to-one, to make sure that all the provinces get equal treatment. Otherwise, some province would lose because one province over-reported. And that's the challenge. But on the allocation side, it's only simulation. We know that the current equitable share is something like 260 million, not the 200 million is reflected, and the conditional grants are 61 million.
No, I'm just should it be like that? Really?
Yes, I want to come in here with reality, Northern Cape and Northwest. Ampistad is one of the areas that was redemarcated to the Northern Cape. But on the border, there's 14 villages. The people in the 14 villages comes to the health facilities in Ampistad and Hartswater to get the service. That's 100% correct. You can't take it away from the people in terms of the constitution. But when it comes to the allocation of funds, it's only the headcount, the people living physically in the Northern Cape. What happened between 1998 and 2001, that came out of the Auditor General's report of then, because I served in the Health Committee and SCOPA, that the Northwest owed Northern Cape 64 million rand for services rendered, but never paid that to the province. So it's actually a minus 64 million to the Northern Cape. And that was accumulating, snowballing. And I asked the question when we had the Appropriations Committee Friday a week ago, and Mr. Kenneth Brown replied that they will look at the people serviced at hospitals and the clinics. This is where the province will have to be vigilant, when they also do their oversight and when members of the legislature visit their constituencies to get those figures. We included members of parliament at national level to visit our institutions and because they've got the logbook, on a weekly basis they dot down how many patients that they see. You can get those figures. It's available. And bring it to the committee or forward it to Treasury. Are the Honourable Mashishiwe, you covered? I see you wanted to ask something.
No, Chair, you covered exactly what I wanted to raise, because it seemed to me that it's old data. Can I ask another question?
Yes.
Chair, I just want to find out from the SFC in the discussion with the National Treasury around the costed norms. Is there progress around that issue? I know that I'm here now, but I come from the Eastern Cape. Would be much more interested in that component, really, because of the earlier discussion, backlogs and so on. Is there progress around that? And another issue I would like to find out, because Eastern Cape suffers from this again, that
in the education component, there's always a problem of school-going children who are over age. Is there any discussion around that? Just to level the situation, just to say we understand that there's nothing you can do about it. There will always be children who are over age, that kind of thing. Is there any discussion around that? Because the third element for me, Chairperson, is exactly what was raised earlier around the flexibility of the budget. Because some provinces, indeed, mine too was complaining a few years ago that the funding formula and the budget are more stringent. It's making it more difficult for provinces to make certain interventions when the need arises because of the tightness of the budget. They can't move because the budget is so tight. The fourth one would be, I know that it's our job to monitor conditional grants, both here at national and at provincial level. Do you think there's anything we can do more to make sure that conditional grants are spent in the manner they should be in terms of really preparations, business plans and so on, up to a point where we are satisfied, all of us, that insofar as conditional grant spending, there are no hiccups at all, given the MDF budgeting and the like. Are we moving towards that in terms of your own analysis of the spending pattern? And if not, why not? Thank you.
Our sources of information is also the quarterly spending reports we get from National Treasury on departments and provinces, so that we utilize when we call in provinces and departments as well as municipalities. Our lady at the back and gentlemen, you must just indicate when you want to come in.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe just on the issue around the alignment that the FFC has alluded to earlier on. Yes, we have seen in over the past 3 or 4 years that there's particular problems in terms of alignment. What we do usually, just to explain the process, in January we go through what we call a benchmark, is to actually see whether provincial drafts, provincial budgets, reflect the priorities as agreed to in terms of the MTVPS, etc., and as the way the funds were allocated. And our observation this year, based on the draft budgets, was actually that there's better alignment, perhaps because there's not a lot of money going around. So there was better alignment between the priority areas for the additional money, because provinces do get an inflationary adjustment, but then there's a portion that is in addition to that which will be prioritized, but it's still unconditional. So it's funded through the equitable share, but it's prioritized for specific areas of spending. In terms of that assessment this year, the only, at the time of the benchmark, the only province where there were differences was with the Northwest province, but that was simply because at that particular point in time, the province did not yet make an allocation. The problem that we had specifically was with the health budget, but they have, in terms of the budget that was tabled on the 4th of March, they've done a reallocation or a realignment of that. But we do see it from time to time, and then the issue around cooperative governance, as a national treasury, we make recommendations back to the province whether the executive then implement those recommendations. It's not something that we can control. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Mashile.
Yeah, Chair, I actually still wanted to talk to that issue, Chair, that I really do not understand how provinces can contest prescriptions on certain national priorities. Because, Chair, it doesn't make sense to me. If a national minister goes and struggles with treasure to get additional funding for specific purpose, but when the funds arrive at the province, they are utilized for something else, surely that is out of order. The FFC, I think, must just put its mind together on this particular matter and see how we can argue this and make sure that it happens. Otherwise, then that will force us to have endless conditional grants. Endless conditional grants, which will actually make it difficult even to manage them. And some of the things which are meant for specific priorities, one understands that they need to be understood as such. And Chair, the other issue that I just wanted to check was in relation to a province like yours, Northern Cape, Mpumalanga, probably as well as Northwest, where you have the administration that has to stretch. You have to have offices almost everywhere because you can't operate from one office. That actually brings in a burden of expenditure, just simply for management and administration. How do we actually factor that in so that then we don't have these poor provinces? Exactly the same with municipalities. I think when you go down to municipalities, there are certain municipalities that have to have regional offices across the whole municipal area because to run from one office is difficult and impossible. And I think we had an experience, I'm sure, in Northern Cape. You know, it's where you have to, if you have to have a project going on in one area, then you must have new people appointed there to run the project. When it's closed, then you fire all of them because you can't operate from the head of you. This kind of things which brings in additional expenditure that must be taken by provinces which have got a weak fiscal capacity. Thanks, President.
Thank you, Honourable Mashida, coming up for the Northern Cape. Are there any quick questions that we're going to give to Mr. Kumalo and his team? Not yet crossed the floor.
Okay, let me, on the issue of, firstly for Honorable Mazosi, on the cost and norms approach, following the recommendations that the Commission tabled in the last round of the review, which were tabled last year, the National Treasury and Budget Council basically agreed to set up a further task team, which basically will look at all sorts of recommendations because provinces, individual provinces, also made their own inputs on what they think should actually happen to the equitable share formula. So the issue of the costed norms approach is one of those which is now sitting in a whole pot, and there's a task team that has actually been set up. Now, the costed norms approach requires sectoral information. So, for example, in that task team that has been set up now by the Treasury, there are people that are looking at sectoral information. For example, what do we have right now? If you would recall that when we first tabled the issue around the costed norms approach, one of the key problem areas was around information. The kind of information that you require for that is massive, and you also require quite a big movement from national departments in terms of actually setting those norms and standards. I remember at the last budget council, Lihutla, I think Julinda was there as well. One of the issues that was discussed there was whether or not it should be an okay thing to provide money to national departments that actually don't have norms and standards for what they expect provinces to fund. So if you come in and say, we want this much money, but you haven't actually established any norms and standards, what do you expect provinces to do? So that's a discussion that is there. And I'm sure as the review progresses, some of these things might actually come up, and we'll have clarity on that one. Now, the issue of education, the education component, and out-of-age learners. One of the
issues that the Commission raised, I think it must have been in 2002, when we were dealing with the equitable share formula and the different components and the data that goes in, was that the education component at that point in time, in fact, used to punish provinces that they've got out of school, because what you had was a waiting for the correct school age cohort, which was higher than the out of age cohort. So you had it on both sides of the scale. So you had people that were sending kids to school at a very early age, and obviously that was because of the absence of early childhood development integrated into the school system. So a lot of people were using the school system as preschool or whatever. So they would send kids very early into the system. And then at the other end, you had very old people because they start school late, or the school is just too far away. And so all of those things, the rural provinces in particular had most of old people that were in the system. Mm-hmm. So what we then decided to do was to say, let's just take enrollment as a number. You take school enrollment, put it there, and then put the school age cohort, and then you so you don't distinguish between school age and out of age, but you take enrollment and then the school age cohort, because you want to encourage everything. So that problem was dealt with in that way. It might not necessarily be perfect. But what we're trying to do was to try and disincentivize people from sending kids to school at a very early age. So you create an ECD, and I think it started off as a conditional grant, and then it was later folded into the school system as grade R. That's what happened there. Now, I think the issue that you are raising of the lack of flexibility. When people look at the formula and they say this is what the formula says, and then people want to expect that budgets must look like that, it's a bit of a problem. And I think it's what Julinda is trying to say and probably trying to solve. I mean, technically speaking, you can put a formula to anything that you want to do. You can actually say, can we design a formula that will do the budget for us? But I think the problem with that is that it takes away, once you introduce a formula, it takes away political discretion. So you can't actually move resources in response to what you consider to be political hotspots, for example. You need that kind of flexibility. And I think if one thinks about it, the reason why we actually don't have a formula-based approach to the vertical division of revenue is simply that you've got to allow for political intervention at some point. And so if one looks at the formula, the way in which the equitable share formula is designed, especially for provinces, it's designed in such a way that you've got your basic component, you've got your poverty component, and then you've got like these key mandates, like your education and health, at this point in time, that's the biggest one. So you can try and influence behavior around that and still maintain some political discretion around the others. Now, the discussion maybe should be, what weighting should we give at that level when you allocate across provinces? Because all you're doing is like the formula does not determine the money, it determines shares. So whatever I do is to indicate that I value education, and as far as provinces are concerned, I value education, I value health as national government. So I'll assign this kind of a weight to these two against the rest of the things that you might want to do as a province and have discretion. But I value these two areas. Those are kinds of things that one is trying to toy around with now, to try and balance that need for balancing your national priorities against provincial flexibility and executive authority at the level of the province. Otherwise, I'm afraid what you're saying, your observation, situation that we might end up having the whole thing conditionalized. It's simply that. That's what Honorable Mashiri is saying. That, because if you don't align national priorities to in a unitary state like we have provinces and stuff, but it's a unitary state, and therefore somewhere something has to give. So if we decide, one can decide that no, let's have most of the transfers in the form of conditional grants, and the constitution does allow that. You can actually do that in order to deal with those things if the other side is not actually responding. That's the option. And to safeguard the kind of principle in the system, one then would like to find these ways that we're trying to do to review this kind of formula so that we balance that. Let me just ask Vincent to speak to the issue of how we can improve conditional grant spending. One thing that I can say is that Lydia was going to talk about conditional grants. Maybe we can park that question to after she's
adjourned. Did she address it in her presentation? Take the question as a presentation, because all the members, we've got 90 minutes. Then you want to ask questions, and we must be out here at 1:30. So I'm just looking at that. So you anticipate the questions and take it into your presentation so that we can cover a lot of work. You might carry on.
Okay, then I'm going to ask Jugal, please try and speed it up. 15, 20 minutes, max. Then it's just going to take us through the local government equitable share formula.
Just on which slide you are in this, for the member side.
Poorer municipalities to fund their administration. just quickly on the local government fiscal framework, where local government has several expenditure responsibilities, which is outlined in Schedule 4 and 5B of the Constitution. In order to fund these expenditures, they have a large array of own revenue sources, much more than provinces. Their own revenue includes property taxes, user charges, etc., and they also have the ability to borrow. Just on the fiscal gap issue, the equitable share and the local government one in particular tries to address where there is a difference between the expenditure needs and the revenue responsibilities of a specific municipality. But the important thing is like similar to provinces, but at a more larger scale, the discrepancies between several types of municipalities is much larger. So therefore, you have different levels of a fiscal gap. So for example, if you take a metropolitan municipality, its average budget size is around 13 billion, compared to an average poorer municipality which has a budget of 88 million. So Just to say also, the gap itself can be vertical, as in local government itself doesn't have enough funds to match its expenditure needs, or it can be horizontal, where a municipality itself doesn't have enough own revenue to match its expenditure needs. Just to reiterate the point, if you take the importance of this slide is, if you take any municipality, it has, of its operating budget, it has around 79%, which is of its own revenue, versus other Lutuli, which is about 51%. So the LEF need to, but local government equitable share need to take this into consideration for to adequately fund these different types of municipalities and these discrepancies in own revenue. Just a very quick evolution of the LEF from 98. I'll just touch on the important changes to the formula. But just to say that the changes to date have taken into account transformation such as redemarcation, the data updates, new priorities for local government such as free basic services and increased demand for basic services. Just to say there have been roughly two formulas used to allocate funds to the local government equitable share. The first one was used from 1998 to 2004. It was then reviewed, and now we have the current formula, which is also under review by the National Treasury. I won't go through the slides in detail, but just to point out a few things. From 2000, the special fund to assist R293 towns, which are towns in former homelands, was incorporated into the equitable share. In 2001, which is a very important point, which we'll see later, in the old formula or the previous formula, we had the income used in the formula was the poverty level used in the formula was households earning less than 800 rand per month. This was then changed in 2001 to imputed expenditure, which was instead of measuring income, it measured expenditure. But as you see with the new formula, it has reverted back to income, which is one of the current issues with the current formula. If you go to the next slide, as I said, in 2004 there was a review of the old formula, and in 2005 an introduction of the basis of the current formula. The current formula itself, there have been roughly two major changes to it. In 2006, a new component, the municipal health component, was introduced, and in 2009, what was called the introduction of a differentiated tax mechanism to improve equalization was introduced. But I'll touch more on these things later on. Just an example for the committee of what the old formula used to look like. The last two sections of the grant didn't apply, but the first two. But from 2004, there were six funding windows as a separate grant mechanism that incorporated the LEF, and this is what it was back in 2004. If we continue, one of the reasons for reviewing the current formula was the funding windows. You see that in the previous slide, we have six separate funding because they weren't incorporated into one formula. So it was felt that this was inefficient, and local practitioners of the formula had more control as to how much goes into it, etc. It was also very complicated. It was, and related to my previous point, wasn't transparent and wasn't flexible for new policies. So in 2004, there was a review, and in 2000, and also just before we go to a new formula, the FFC had several recommendations on the new formula, of which many have been incorporated. In 2002, the FFC made a recommendation to link the LEX directly to the provisions, as my colleague touched on earlier, in Section 214, such as provinces and municipalities' ability to provide services, etc. In 2003, the FFC recommended that the funding window approach be removed, and in 2004, we also recommended that the costing for the basic services grant, which is meant to fund services for municipalities, be based on a costing methodology, and there should be a new component that takes into account the fiscal capacity and distances between the fiscal capacities of the different municipalities, as we saw earlier, like for example, Itegwini and Albert Lituli. This is the current format in use. Unlike the provincial equitable share, it's not share based. It's more on determining the needs of a municipality based on the demographic, and just pushing out an allocation does not, as the provincial equitable is percentage or share based. Just to quickly go through it. It's made up generally of five components. It's the basic services component, which is intended to fund basic services and free basic services. The institutional component, which is there to assist to fund the municipality's administration and other administrative needs. A development component, which is intended to fund a local government development needs. And then there's the revenue-raising component, which attempts to take into consideration the different fiscal capacities of the different municipalities, and a correction component, which ensures that the entire pool for the given year is used up, and a guarantee mechanism, which I'll touch on later, is ensured. If you just look at the table below, it just shows the different shares of each component for the different types of municipalities. Just to touch on the municipalities themselves, the table is developed into your six metros, your 21 secondary cities, such as Polokwane and Mangaung, for example, larger towns, medium to larger towns, and your rural municipalities. And then you have your districts that are authorized for a few powers of function and those that are not. There's some important features of the new equitable share. In most cases, municipalities are treated uniformly, apart maybe from the revenue-raising component and also the basic services. Allocations are done within the MTF, 3-year budgeting cycle. The important thing with that is that the formula tries to guarantee allocation based on the MTF, on the existing allocation as part of the MTF to ensure stable budgeting. So what the formula does is it will guarantee your first-year allocation based on the Division of Revenue Act, what's published, 90% in the second year and then 0% in the third year. Funds also follow functions. In local government, there's the two-tier system of service delivery, where either a local municipality or a district municipality is authorized for a specific function, usually the water and sanitation function. So whoever authorized, that's the municipality that would get the allocation. The development component is highly inactive. This is due to government and related stakeholders not agreeing on what needs to be funded and how it should be funded. The last two points I was hoping to actually show it in when we actually run the simulation, but we won't get the time to. But similar to the PES or the provincial equitable share, if you change parameters within the formula, all you see is shift from one instance to other. The only way to get again to local municipality as a whole is done at the vertical division, similar to the provincial equitable share. So if you want all of local government to gain, instead of changing with the parameters, you would have to increase the overall pool to local government. They want a basic services component. As I said, it's to enable municipalities to provide basic services. It also attempts to link to the municipal infrastructure grant, whereby the MIG would be used, or the MIG would be used to roll out infrastructure, and then the related operating costs would be factored into the LES to fund such additional operating costs related to new infrastructure. Just a few characteristics on the component itself. It supports households earning less than 800 per month. Like I said previously, the previous one also used the same poverty line, but it then changed to imputed expenditure of 1,100, but now we have reverted that back to using RAN 800 per month. And this is, before I continue, it's all based on 2001 census, which is one of the technical problems found with the formula. It recognizes water, sanitation, refuse, electricity, and environmental health as the basic services, and these are the five services that are funded through this component. And it also makes the distinction between households that are connected to services, which will get a higher subsidy through the formula, versus households that are not connected, which will get a lower subsidy. Just to show you how this works, it's a bit cut at the bottom there. If you take, like I said, the base services fund five of the services. If you take the first one, it calculates the subsidy per municipality for water by timesing the subsidy by the number of poor households connected to water, plus a different subsidy times the number of households that are not connected. So it's done for each component. That up to electricity. Environmental health accrues only to metros and district municipalities, and not to local municipalities. This is calculated by 150 per household, which is different from the other four. Just to go into more detail on the actual subsidy levels, if you see the top table, at the moment, poor households connected to water would get 30 rand a month subsidy versus 10 rand for a household that's not connected. So putting all of this together, you would get a basic services allocation for a specific municipality. The table below just shows the different shares per the different types of municipalities. The important part here is that because the electricity subsidy, which is currently at 45 years, is larger than it therefore makes up more share of the allocation for the specific municipalities. Let's move on to the I component or the institutional component. Its purpose is, like I said, to fund administration within a municipality. It's also deemed, and I'm not sure how accurate it is, but it's also deemed to be the avenue to fund your poorer municipalities. It goes to all municipalities, but just to add that in the previous I grant or in the previous equitable share formula that used to have, they also had an I grant. The grant didn't go to your metros and your larger urban areas because it was deemed that they have sufficient fiscal capacity to fund their administration. But now it goes to everybody. But the important feature here is that it assumes high economies of scale in local administration would increase population. So your per capita allocation will decrease the larger your population, so which is attempts to level it out between your poorer and your richer municipalities. This is the structure of the I component. There's a base component, which is a set amount to all municipalities, plus admin support, which is a subsidy per a person within the municipality, and a counselor support, which is a subsidy per the number of council seats within the municipality. The current subsidy level is 350,000 rand for the base component, 1 rand, which is a bit cut there, but it's 1 rand per person within the municipality, and it's 36,000 rand per a council seat. The table below just shows the different shares between the types of municipalities. You see that the largest component there is the council one, but you have the base component that's important for your medium to larger towns and even a bit towards your rural municipalities, but not the metro. So it's supposed to play like redistributive role, but the revenue raising component, like I said, was factored into the formula to take into consideration the different fiscal capacities and the ability to raise revenues of different types of municipalities. This is largely a bit technical in nature, but I'll try to go through it. One, your basic services and your I component is calculated by the formulas that I showed previously. You would have the revenue raising component correcting, as in subtracting funds to be redistributed to your poorer municipalities. Previously, prior to 2009, what would happen is you would have your predicted property rate or property rate for each municipality predicted using an econometric formula, and your RSC levy, which is a grant, so the grant is determined outside the formula, similar to the predicted property rate. And what happened, a 5% tax would be applied to each one and then subtracted from the overall allocation. But in order to improve equalization as such, in 2009-10, the National Treasury introduced a differentiated tax system, whereby if you a relatively richer municipality and you had a higher own revenue per capita, you would get taxed at a higher rate than that of a poorer municipality. So if you look at the table below, usually a poorer municipality will have a low operating revenue per capita, say between 0 and 500, so it will be taxed 1.5%, but a richer municipality would be taxed 9.5%. And then this is how the tax system works. Just to point out something very quickly, that previously, like I said, the property rate was predicted, but now what National Treasury does is it uses actual property rates and which is adjusted for inflation to correct in this component, which if you look at section 2272 of the Constitution may be unconstitutional, but you have to assume that. This graph just shows very briefly the shares between each type of municipality over from 2002 to 2012. Just important to point out that from 2005 the new formula was introduced, and from 2009 the differential tax approach was introduced. If you see from 2002 to 2004-05, you have most of the funds going to your rural municipalities. And now with the introduction of a new formula, this has changed to a certain extent and has been more to your urban municipalities. There's a lot of factors that could explain that, like, for example, developing your rural municipalities, which used to be in former homelands, and there's several factors that could explain that. Then the problem that government had from 2005 to 2008-09 was that more and more funds were going to the urban municipalities. So with the new tax rate introduced, they looked at reversing that trend. So from 2009 to 2012, you see a drop as such from 2008-09 to 2009-10, and then gradually it increases again. So that was the purpose of the differentiated tax approach. I'll just very, very quickly go through the technical some issues that is currently in the formula and that has been the result of the current review. The measure of poverty, it has always been around 800 since 1988, except for that period where it moved to imputed expenditure. There's no inflation adjustment to it, which is fine for now, which is fine if the data is not updated, which it currently isn't. But if you have to update the data, then the RAN 800, it can be argued, is a bit too low, because if you look at the current social grants that go to households, your pensioner's grant, for example, is much more than RAN 800. And international studies have shown that imputed expenditure is more accurate than income. The data update, the current formula still uses 2001 census. It's only possible to update the formula every 10 years with a new census. So therefore, to account for migration and changes in service levels won't be factored into the formula. That's one of the issues. The basic service component, the actual subsidy is not based on any, it's based on an outdated costing framework, which was done in 2004. Obviously, costs have changed from then, so that's also an issue. Similar with the I component, there's no cost basis for subsidizing municipalities administration because most of the parameters used are not, I mean, there's no basis for them. Is it necessary for your metro and urban areas to get the I component when this should be more or less funding your rural municipalities? There is really a component. I brought up the possible unconstitutionality of it and several other technical problems with it, but I won't go into too much detail on that. And the development component is, like I said, internationally most transfers are for social nature, so do we really still need it? I think this is my last slide. I'll just quickly touch it. Like we saw in the previous slide, we do have a large differentiation between your richer municipalities and your poorer municipalities. And if you, with the current mid-grant, you do have a differentiated approach as such, where we differentiate between the cities and their urban capacity versus the rural municipalities. So should we look at that more for the LES and attempt to fund municipalities more appropriately via the differentiated approach? And the funding of maintenance through the LES and to improve the link with the municipal infrastructure grant. As you might know, that there can't be a large maintenance backlog. So the idea of maybe funding this maintenance and the maintenance that accrues with new infrastructure through the local infrastructure is also an option. I won't go through the simulation model and the planning illustration because we don't have time left. But thank you.
Thank you. I think we will take the last presentation and take the questions from both. Honourable members, we will not break formally for tea. If you need a cup of tea, fetch it, bring it in, and enjoy your tea while you are listening to the presentation.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Basically, I'm going to be presenting on FFC framework for assessing conditional grants. In terms of what will be covered, I'll look at the background, which will also include issues that have been raised by FFC in terms of the implementation of the grants. And then secondly, I will look at the performance measures, looking at both financial and non-financial data. And then I'll touch on the issues around monitoring and evaluation mechanisms and capacity. And then after that, I'll look at the conclusion and the way forward. Just to touch on a bit of the background, conditional grants are the main fiscal tool of national policy. In terms of the trend, if one looks at a trend between 2005 and 2006, the share of municipal and provincial revenue from conditional grants increased from 11.8% to 19.1% to provinces, and from 7.7% to 14% for local government. However, what has been realized is that over the past 10 years, it has been usual for the rate of underspending or over-budgeting on conditional grants, which basically is higher than all raised revenue. This basically might indicate problems that are related to the establishment cost, specifically for new grants, or the issue of the burden of additional and repetitive reporting requirements. Just to touch on the issues that the FFC managed to pick up in terms of the implementation of the grant. Just to start touching on the issue of the principles in the use of conditional grants and the type of grants. The first principle is to address national priorities, and the example of the grants is infrastructure grants, school nutrition programs, and HIV/AIDS grants. And then there's other grants that are basically dealing with the horizontal and vertical fiscal spillovers. Examples of these grants are National Tertiary Services Grant and Health Professional Training Grant. On the types of grants, I'm not going to dwell much on that because my colleague has already touched on them and also explained the differences between the matching and non-matching grants. So I'm going to skip that. And then in terms of the issues that the FFC managed to pick up when assessing the implementation of the grants, FFC has been basically advising on the issue of likelihood of replication between the grants, especially when looking at the purpose and the necessity of various grants. For example, in the current financial year, the Division of Revenue Bell, there are about 3 new grants to provinces and 1 new grant to municipalities that are introduced, while there are 2 local grants that have been discontinued. And then last year, there were about 5 new grants which were added to local government. And then there's also an issue on transitional grant, where you find that most of these grants usually they persist for many years while they are transitional grants. And then we've also looked at the issue of consistency in design of grants, where there are varying interpretations of the criteria. For instance, many capital grants do not follow through on the recurrent implications such as maintenance and operations. This basically is the basis for the committee making recommendations on seeking the link between the equitable share and capital grants. And then there's also an issue of some of the grants being disconnected in that they cut across programs. And this may reflect a lack of consultation between national and sub-national departments. And then on the criteria for allocating conditional grants, which actually links to what the honorable member has raised on the budget, you know, for conditional grants. Basically, currently the division between provinces and municipalities is based on measures such as total population, poverty, population in poverty or size of the economy, depending on the objective of the grant. However, one would argue that if one is looking at future budgets, you can either sort of estimate them according to an independent costing of plant outputs, which you link it, of course, to your the business plans that the province or the local government has submitted, or it can also be based on your inflationary adjustments. In terms of the performance measures, there is a need to conceptualize both non-financial and financial data. For instance, as I've indicated, the criteria for allocating future budget is not clear, which basically means that there is a need for reliable financial costing model. And then many conditional grants, they either lack or have inconsistent measures of non-financial performance. For example, if you look at a grant called ILIMA, LITEME, one would ask a question of how is it different from a grant called Comprehensive Agricultural Support Program. And then basically, we say Parliament should monitor and enforce a non-financial reporting mechanism, especially if one will have to do proper budgeting and also looking at the issue of accountability. And then just to move further to performance measures, basically as FFC we highlighting that departments should at least require or provide measures of the number of beneficiaries and of physical inputs such as staff, buildings and other goods and services. The committee should also note that it's also important to provide measures of socio-economic impact, looking at your employment generation, productivity, skills and economic growth. And then looking at the issue of monitoring and evaluation mechanisms and capacity, we realize that there are challenges in conducting effective monitoring of grant performance. For instance, there are challenges related to staff and skills to evaluate and monitor performance, which might be in government departments or independent institutions. And then there are also problems related to systems in place and capacity problems. And then also touching on the issue that I've spoken about already on the availability of non-financial data, which is critical for actually also answering the question of what informs MTF allocations going forward, and also links to accountability of public funds. And then basically what we're saying is that monitoring requires appropriate non-financial mechanisms in place. Sorry, Nandia, my position. And then in terms of conclusion and way forward, from this year, the Commission will report to Parliament regularly on its assessment of the Section 32 reports as tabled by National Treasury and National Departments. And then to this end, the Commission, we expect to add value through the development of a framework of assessment that is more comprehensive, taking into account the grant performance to the original stated goals, periodic evaluation of grant effectiveness and impact, and then we'll also do a periodic assessment of the design of the grants and conditionality. We also intend to have extensive consultation with national departments on reporting variances between budget and actual figures. Because what is happening now is that the provinces they are submitting the in-year monitoring reports, but you'll find that there isn't really non-financial data that is actually linked to the figures that the provinces or municipalities are submitting to Treasury. So the FFC will meet with those the national department dealing with specific sectors so that we can at least have a sense of what are the reasons behind the trends. And then third, I will seek to evaluate grant design and allocation criteria in respect of acceptable FFC recommendations. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Marika Kumalo. Are there any other presentations to be done?
There was one more presentation around budget analysis that
Can you are a bit ahead of time. I think you must take that, do that, and then we take questions on all three.
Okay. Can you also be very quick?
Honourable members, I'm going to review the budget analysis function at the FSC.
Slide 80, or what is the number?
I'll be looking at a couple of, after introduction, we'll look at a couple of definitions and indicators, followed by the budget process and outputs. If we have time, we can then look into an actual analysis of either the provinces or the municipalities, depending on what the committees want, and then finally conclusions and way forward. In terms of the in respect of an introduction, what is budget analysis? Well, the answer to that depends a lot on whether there's financial data or non-financial data available. So to pick up on the theme that Lydia mentioned, that we can do a lot more if we have non-financial data. With the data that's available, we can review past trends, particularly those that affect future budget needs and policy priorities. You'll see in the example how we do that. We can look at budget summaries and examine budgets for their completeness, accuracy, and conformance to regulations. This can also be used to estimate the resources required to initiate new legislation or a new program of projects. And then what we're doing now, testifying before examining and fund-granting bodies. If we have data available on beneficiaries and the number of assets and the number of staff and so on, it becomes possible to do unit cost and benefit analyses, and we can start estimating what the value for money is. So we can look at efficiency, if we can measure, if we can link financial cost to what's been produced. We can look at effectiveness, if we can link the cost to the type of impact that's achieved on society. We can look at the equity between provinces, between municipalities, and in fact the rate of reduction of the backlog. In terms of the budget analysis unit itself at the FSC, our objective is to assist Parliament and provincial legislatures to understand, review, and suggest amendments to short and medium-term budgets. Broadly, our philosophy is that budgets should be as legible as possible, which means as much non-financial data to be included as possible, and as a tool to enabling accountable institutions. The type of recommendations that we make might relate to the formats of budget reports of strategic plans so that they link up. The type of data that's required, particularly non-financial data, because financial data is generally pretty good. What kind of links there are to policy priorities and strategic plans and capacity and transmission mechanisms. To come to the second part of the presentation, looking at some of our definitions and indicators, there's a distinction between medium and long-term analysis of the budget and short-term analysis. In the medium term, you're talking about 1 to 3 years, and in the long term, 3 to 7 years. Now, for these type of medium to long-term analysis, we are very reliant on data from the National Treasury, entirely reliant. They're the estimates of national expenditure for any analysis of the national government. Coming out this year will be the local budget and expenditure review. Next year is the provincial budget and expenditure review. Medium-term budget policy statement and the budget review that's just recently come out. And in this we compare, you'll see the type of analysis that I'll present, that we compare the past 3 years against the three-year budget forecast for revenue spending and deficits. The indicators that we use are derived, as indicated in some of the earlier presentations, are from Section 214A to J. So, for example, if we're looking at national interest needs and obligations, we'll look at what the policy priorities are and see whether the budgets reflect that, either in terms of the importance attached to the budget or the growth of that budget. Then, in respect of the provinces and municipalities, we'll look at the service delivery obligations, given that if data is available, the capacity, in other words, how much revenue the provinces and municipalities have, how efficiently they are distributing it. Then there's finally a question of stability versus flexibility. Budgets, the revenue depends on the economy, which is cyclical. So, and yet there are certain types of expenditures, particularly on basic needs, which require a fairly stable growth path. So if certain things need a stable growth path and the revenue is falling, other parts have to be flexible and be cut. And we'll see what actually happens. That's the medium to long-term analysis. The short-term analysis, or what's called in-year monitoring, involves looking at data on a monthly or quarterly basis. And here we look at various aspects, the revenue collections and the spending disbursements. What's called the hockey stick effect is where money tends to get spent at the end of the year rather than being more spread more equally across the year. And this is one of the things that the Section 32 reports will attempt to rectify. Within the course of the year, there are various things, and there's some distinctions are made between underspending, rollovers, savings, and so on, which can sometimes be quite tricky. Underspending simply means that at the end of the year, if you haven't spent all of your budget, there's underspending. Some would argue that's the same problem as over-budgeting. In other words, you're giving too much budget for the capacity of the department to actually spend. If the underspending is planned and realized well beforehand, it can be rolled over into the next year, particularly capital programs. If not, it sometimes gets passed on to a lower level of government. So, for instance, national might pass on to provincial might pass on to local might pass on to one of their service providers. So that what happens is the money gets given to that department at the end of the year and they can't spend it within that year. Savings are meant to be where one tries to cut down on administrative costs and travel and unnecessary stuff that's unnecessary for service delivery. Now, that has been a problem over the past few years. What we now have is the opposite problem, where we're overspending. In other words, we're spending more than what's available for the budget. Arguably, many departments will say that this is also under-budgeting. Environments are where money that has not been spent can be shifted to another department or perhaps to another province in the, or municipality in the case of conditional grants. And this is often very contentious. In terms of the budget process and where we might be able to assist Parliament in helping to amend the budget, as of last year there was the Money Bills Amendment Act was enacted, and over the course of time, Parliament will start beginning to negotiate budgets with the executive. Some of the landmarks, of course, the are the budget review and recommendation reports for various portfolio committees. These are due in July. There'll be a review of the local government budget and expenditure review, which I think is due in September this year. Then there'll be the medium-term budget policy statement and the division of revenue and appropriation goals. In terms of in-year monitoring, there are quarterly reports, Section 32 for the provinces and Section 71 for the municipalities. And those come out every quarter. There's also the adjustments budget in October. So there's a difference then again between the medium-term analysis and the short-term in-year analysis. This is now giving you an example of a medium-term analysis. Just to note that there's a distinction between nominal and real growth rates. Nominal are the figures that the Treasury will give you. Real is, and that includes both increases in quantity and increases in prices. Real annual growth means that you've taken out the effect of inflation, so you're only looking at the increase in quantity. The second analytical term here is growth path stability or volatility. Ideally, spending and budget should grow maybe 2 or 3% per year. If they're growing by 10% in the 1 year and dropping down to minus 1% in the next year, that becomes a very volatile growth path. And if you've got that type of growth path, it's very difficult for a department to plan effectively and therefore to implement and deliver services effectively. So the more volatile a growth path, the more difficult it is to deliver. Now, in terms of the situation analysis, we look at the macroeconomy. Most of you will know this, that the economy has been decelerating quite rapidly since 2005-06. In this past year, it actually declined by over 1% in real terms. However, for the next 3 years, growth is anticipated to pick up. And by the outer year, it will reach nearly 4%, 3.7%, or at least that's the prediction. We'll see how that goes in reality. By contrast, government spending has been accelerating. So while the economy has been decelerating and even declining, general government spending has been increasing in real terms by nearly 10% per year. Now, this can't be sustained, so it's projected to decelerate quite sharply over the next 3 years to just over 1% per annum. Again, we'll see whether that turns out in reality. So if government spending is intended to counter the business cycle, it didn't do that during the boom. It was growing with the boom, but now during the recession, it is being counted. It is going against the cycle by spending while the economy is retracting. As a result of this, the proportion of the economy that's been devoted to government has increased from 29.4% in 2005. 34% this year, that's 2009-10. It's projected to decline over the 3 years because government spending should be declining. Within the vertical division of revenue, in other words, the link between national, provincial, and local government, there's a very clear shift away from national towards provincial and towards municipal levels. So, for example, the provinces increased their share from 34 to 36.5%. And municipalities even more rapidly from 22 to 27.5%. So there's a big shift over the past four, and it's continued to carry on growing. Now, when we look at provincial governments themselves, only 4.5% of revenue was raised by the provinces, and this has been declining, and is projected to continue to decline. So any attempts to try and get provinces to raise more of their own revenue is failing. So while government is decentralizing its spending, the revenue is highly centralized and it's becoming more so. So there's a view that provinces lack any fiscal autonomy or lack fiscal autonomy. It's also being reflected in the preference of government for conditional over unconditional grants, and Lydia pointed out how those are increasing. The unconditional provincial equitable share projected to grow by about 1% per annum over the next 3 years. By comparison, conditional grants are growing much faster at 4%. So that explains this shift towards conditional grants. In terms of whether the provinces are contributing towards the surplus or deficit, well, provinces generated small surpluses in 2006 and 2007. Swung sharply into deficits over the past 2 years. It's projected that this will not continue. Again, we'll see whether this happens. In respect of spending, so that's looking at the funding or revenue side. In respect of spending, the biggest component is education for provinces, but this share has been declining, so from 45% to currently 42%. Health spending has been growing at slightly below average, and the contribution of health has therefore remained roughly constant. I think it's about 26-27% of provincial budgets. Now, during the boom years, spending on infrastructure was well above average, and what's happened now during the recession is that it has been cut back and is in fact declining. So what this is saying is that capital spending is pro-cyclical. In other words, it increases when we have more money during a boom and declines rapidly when we have less. And it is serving as a shock absorber or the flexible component of spending. To some degree, the administrative services such as President's Office, provincial legislatures, the Treasury, are also, they rise during a boom and get cut back during the recession. But because there's a large component of personnel, it's somewhat less volatile than the infrastructure spending. Provinces, what did happen is that in the past few years, personnel spending did not grow very fast, and as a result, in fact, real wages declined slightly. What's happened in the past 2 years is that we've had higher than average increases in the public sector wage bill. We've also had the occupational specific dispensation for educators and health workers, health practitioners. And in real terms, the wage bill has increased by 9-12% over the past 2 years. As indicated, this is not projected to continue, but we shall see. With respect to goods and services, such as learner support materials, medicines, maintenance, this is a more flexible part of the budget, so it's a more volatile component. A last point that I wanted to make is that so capital spending is the most unstable and pro-cyclical component of provincial government budgets. And in fact, it's being passed on by the national government through its conditional grant programs. That is very much the same story for local government. And I can go through the analysis for local government if you wish. Okay, for municipal governments, in terms of funding, this analysis is on the aggregate, in other words, it's all municipalities, and this is heavily dominated by the metros and the urban municipalities. So these trends that I'm describing here talk more to urban than they do to rural municipalities. Revenue that is raised by the municipalities is about 70% of the funding, and this trend has been declining. So again, more money is coming from intergovernmental transfers, from grants. However, the share from property rates and service charges is expected to rise, and it's going to be rising to about 16.5% of municipal revenue for property rates and 37% for the service charges, that's electricity, water, and sanitation charges. We've recently, in the past, and I think it was 2006-07 or so, disestablished the regional services levy. This has been replaced by a conditional grant, increases in the equitable share, and now the fuel levy sharing arrangement. While this grant had to be got rid of because of constitutional reasons, it caused a lot of volatility in municipal budgets. So there was quite a drop in the revenue received, particularly by metros, and it only got made up several years later. It was not immediate. Municipalities are not allowed, they don't report deficits on their capital accounts. So what we do is we compare how much external loans they have for capital funding against the surpluses that are generated in the operating accounts. In general, municipalities generate 5 to 6% of funding as surpluses. But what's happened is that during the boom years, those operational surpluses were more than the external loans, and now that situation is reversed. So that it suggests then that again there's deficit financing for the municipalities. So just as it is for national, so it is for provinces, so it is for municipalities, all three levels of government. In terms of spending by municipal governments, we don't have the disaggregated data to do trends for more than 1 year for water, electricity and transport, so we'll do that next time. Personnel makes up about 25% of the municipal spending, and this has been rising slowly, but the budget represents wage restraint, so this is not projected to continue rising. What is projected to rise are the bulk purchases of electricity and water, and this reflects the expectations of tariff increases. Now, when we start moving to spending, we can see that the repairs and maintenance, and again, capital, is much more volatile. So it's a part of the budget which tends to get cut during the recession and tends to get increased during the boom. Having said that, municipalities have taken repairs and maintenance quite seriously, so this is growing faster than average, and the contribution rises from 5.5% to 6.3%. What's really volatile is capital spending, growing 25% in real terms over the past 3 years, now declining by nearly 5% over the next three. And this volatility comes from all sources of capital revenue, but particularly the grants from national government. So as a conclusion then, government revenue tends to go with the cycle at all levels of government, even if it is passed on, and may even exaggerate the business cycle on local economies. So there's a certain limit to how much government can actually counter the recession. Generally, governments maintain a fairly stable growth path for personnel and for essential goods and services. So education, health, water, sanitation follow a relatively stable growth path. But if they are stable, other parts become more flexible. And that's capital, administrative spending, non-essential goods and services, training. The one problem with this is that if we're cutting back on capital, infrastructure and training, it's counterproductive to laying the foundations for any future growth. So it's responding to the circumstances rather than preparing for the future. In terms of the way forward, some of the suggestions I think have largely been covered by Lydia, but we need to look at more research into how we work from financial inputs, which are our budgets, to what is actually produced in terms of the number of schools or the number of teachers or the number of medications or the number of kilometres of roads that are produced, what the outcomes and developmental impacts are. So does the HIV/AIDS grant reduce the prevalence of HIV? Does the nutrition grant reduce levels of malnutrition? Do these grants contribute to increases in employment and so on and so forth? That type of data, which enables us to measure efficiency and effectiveness, still needs to be collected in a more coherent way. We also need to start looking, it's been suggested that we look at linkages between policy objectives and the legal framework, the capacity of departments and delivery bodies to deliver, capacity of governance, as well as different levels of service delivery, different types of service delivery, and how they relate to the accountability in institutions. Some of the work that we hope to be able to develop over time, and as with
Thank you, Mr. Kumal and your team. Honourable members, there were three presentations. We've got time for questions and reply. We're a bit ahead of time. I'm taking the... that order.
A point of clarity, Chair, are we doing, are we asking questions of all three presentations
yes.
at once?
Yes.
Thanks, Chairperson. The issue of over budgeting has been answered by the last presenter here. I wanted to ask a question on that. When the lady was presenting here, she mentioned the issue of the staff and the skill challenges. Is there any plan to rectify such type of thing, because it will continue if we don't take a step in order to rectify that? On the budget analysis conclusion 7.1, first bullet, can we get clarity there? I mean, I don't understand it. I don't know the page number, but it is on paragraph 7, conclusion 1. The bullet 1 only. Just to explain further. Thanks.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think the first comment that one wants to make is that, as you have already indicated, this is a lot of information that comes in at one time. And of course, there are many issues, especially the rationale behind, where we have got different views. And the kind of time that we are having is not allowing us to engage on this. And one would have make a plea that maybe we should have another time or session, you know, where we can really engage on some of the rationale behind some of the proposals or recommendations or the views that the FFC is making recommendations based on. Chair, the one question I think that I asked in the past session was the issue in relation to the fiscal gap, the manner in which it is viewed and addressed, whether it has got, whether it is meant to sustain or to be developmental. I think that's what I asked. I think it was not talked to. I would still like to understand whether my view is in line with the FFC or not. Then the other question is that there is still insistence on using income less than 800 rands per annum, and we have had sector determinations and minimum wages that have been prescribed, I think at one stage 1,200. Is this insistence on minus on less than 800 rands not disadvantaging rural provinces or rural municipalities where that is used to determine the population that is in poverty? That's just what I just want to know. And then the other issue is the one that we have been talking to, that unconditional grants, provinces are reporting expenditure only after they have transferred the funds to implementing agents in the form of either municipalities or NGOs or whatever, without actually the funds being spent on the ground. And they report to Treasury and as the funds spent. And how can we intervene in that situation and make sure that the reports are genuine? Wherever money is said to be spent, it should have been transformed into a
the other thing, Chair, is just simply to ask the FSC whether they have looked on the traditional budget process of Treasury in relation to the implication of the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, where there are areas that needs to be changed or reviewed to make sure that the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act is phased in to form one streamlined budget process. I'm sure you'll be knowing that there are time constraints that the Money Bills is bringing in, but if you go on a normal Treasury budget process, there is a lot of conflict along the line. Whether you have looked at those particular areas and whether there are any recommendations that needs to be made to make sure that we streamline that, or will require amendments into the Money Bill Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act that you can share with us. Thanks.
Honourable Harris.
Thank you, Chair. I'll try and keep it broken down into the three sections. The first report on the local government equitable share, perhaps the presenter could just fill me in a gap in my knowledge. The designation of district municipalities without powers and functions, what do they spend money on if they don't have powers and functions? Can you just explain that to me? And then on the basic services component, you ran us through the breakdown of the formula for municipalities. And can you explain why, as municipalities get smaller and more rural, the sanitation component drops dramatically relative to, it seems, the electricity subsidy, with refuse subsidy remaining relatively stable as the municipalities get smaller? Then in the revenue-raising components formula, the RSC levy was obviously replaced now with a fuel levy. Obviously, those rates are different, so that must have had quite a significant effect on the actual amounts transferred. Can you run us through what happened there when that transition happened? You speak about, and the FSC often speaks about, the role of the metros and urban municipalities in economic development. I read it in your assessment of the division of revenue too. Can somebody from the team just expand on that and what the implications are if we discover that metro municipalities, as we probably will, have a significant role to play in economic development, and in a sense they act as multipliers of their investment, where municipalities that don't drive economic development might not have that multiplier effect. Just what the implications will be for the formulas. And then the conditional grants was next. On the third slide, again, the same story comes up about how the equitable shares have been carved up to make conditional grants, and the FSC is always critical of this. Obviously, the problem with that criticism is that you actually have poor municipalities or ineffective municipalities that aren't spending the money properly. So on the one hand, you need to carve up the equitable share to force them to do it to a degree. But on the other hand, by doing that, you compromise the autonomy of better functioning municipalities. How do we deal with that contradiction? Because you're consistently critical, but I'd like your view on that contradiction, which would be the counter-argument to your criticism. Then there was, I might have missed it, but if you could just explain two things, the spillovers and externalities associated with the horizontal and vertical splits. How is there a spillover externality? Can you explain how that is diagnosed and defined? And then also the idea that you would establish linkages between the equitable shares and capital grants. How would you link those two transfers? Then you spoke about a deficit of staff and skills to evaluate and monitor performance.
which I'm trying to work out who would have oversight responsibilities for these conditional grants. Is it the departments themselves, or provincial treasuries, or even national treasury? And depending on the answer, are you talking about those institutions having a lack of staff and skills to monitor performance? So if you clarify who has the oversight, and then your explanation for why they do lack of capacity. And then lastly, Chair, on the budget analysis, there seems to me, and I haven't done this work myself, but I just have memories of budget speeches and budget reviews especially that float policies that don't eventually make it into the budget. I'm not talking about that. I understand that the medium-term budget policy statement does often propose ideas that don't necessarily get adopted, but the budget review document itself often announces new policy directions, and then that isn't followed up. Surely this is a problem, and if it is, I mean, firstly, has the FSC noticed that happening, and do you think it's a problem if it is happening? Then I asked Treasury last week, they're talking about their savings drive, and I asked them about the difference between savings or underspending. Is it not possible to just say that your underspending is now a saving? They were quite cynical about that. So I'd like to know the FFC's view. Is that a risk that you could, that we're simply rebranding understanding? Then the last presenter spoke about attempts to get provinces to raise their own revenue. I know the FFC supports that idea, but surely we can't seriously suggest that we've been attempting to do that unless national government gives away some of their taxes, because nobody's suggesting we want to significantly raise the overall tax burden. So I would argue that there haven't been attempts to get provinces to raise their own revenue simply because SARS hasn't let go of any nationally raised revenue. So can you justify that statement? And then you speak about the provinces generating deficits. I'm interested in the history of this and the mechanism for dealing with that debt. Do the provinces, are they just expected to manage their debt using their equitable share? And what has our history of this been? And then what are the risks when a provincial deficit or debt manager might get out of control? If a province gets into a debt situation that they can't pay back themselves, I mean, then are we in the realm of national interventions? And what happens then? And what is the history in that regard? The last presenter, there were some definitional problems that I had with some of his statements. On 5.2, on the, it's a spending by provincial governments. The statement is made that capital spending is pro-cyclical and therefore serves as a shock absorber. To me, that's a contradiction in terms. A shock absorber would be counter-cyclical expenditure. Pro-cyclical expenditure would actually accelerate or worsen the shock. This has come up over and over, these huge increases in real wages very recently. Does FFC have an explanation for why we suddenly had this big jump in real wage increases? And then again, another potential contradiction related to that is this comment on slide 6.2.1, where the presenter said that budgeted wage restraint over the medium term does not stop the trend of personnel kind of growth, of personnel spend growth, inflation. You seem to indicate in your presentation that it did stop the trend, whereas on the paper it says it did not stop the trend. What is the status with personnel spend growth? That's it, Chair.
Any more questions? Mr. Kumalo, you captured all of them. I think this is an 8-4 page full of questions. You may proceed.
There's quite a lot of questions that have been asked, and I'll just speak to a few.
and then I'll ask the relevant presenters to come in. Let me, I think, Honorable Mashile, on the issue of the fiscal gap, I think it was something just happened whilst we were busy trying to respond to that question in the earlier session. I think the issue of the fiscal gap is a very big and real problem, because you've got to look at it in terms of where you want to direct the system at. In South Africa, what we have is a fiscally decentralized unitary state. Now, the fiscally decentralized state is a result or an outcome of a negotiated process. And if one thinks back to the negotiations and where the different sides were actually sitting in terms of that, because there's one extreme which basically talks about fiscal federalism. Now, the gaps that you actually have are as a result of the assignment of powers that one has to spend and powers that one has to tax. In any really fiscally decentralized system, you would have the two very closely linked. If you look at the South African case, especially as it relates to provinces, because the fiscal gap is really quite huge between national and provincial government. It is not so much of an issue with respect to local government because of the nature of the services that local government provides. Its user pays. So in general, we can talk about a horizontal gap in the local government sphere. But the biggest problem is the vertical gap between province and national. And there, obviously, the assignment of revenue sources as opposed to the assignment of spending responsibilities becomes an issue, because it's an issue of control. How do you control and direct the direction in which you want the system to evolve? Now, the evolution of this system basically falls from where we sit at the Financial and Fiscal Commission, and I will take you back to the first set of recommendations where the Commission met, and I think this basically must serve as also a response to Honorable Harris' question in terms of how do we ensure that provinces raise sufficient revenue if national is not creating the tax room for them to do that. There's obviously an issue. If you look at the first set of recommendations that the Commission made, on the basis of the assigned revenue sources, which basically the Constitution did not exactly assign revenue sources for provinces, excluded certain taxes where provinces could not actually go. So you can impose taxes on 1, 2, 3, but you can't go into this. Now you have to identify, so you can impose such charges or you can piggyback basically on certain bases. And when the Commission looked at that, first time around was to say, which is the biggest base where you can actually piggyback? Because at the end of the day, you need a tax that is buoyant, that basically responds to changes in economic growth. You need a tax that is elastic, that is also responsive to changes. For example, if you change rates, it must actually respond. If you change rules, it must actually respond. Now, if you can only impose a surcharge, you are not responsible for changing the rules. So you have no control over that kind of thing. So the point that one basically is trying to make here is it's about the commitment to actually empower it. So that's a political decision. The legislation is there that allows provinces to say we are going to do 1, 2, 3 things. And I think the only province that has made any attempt at that is the Western Cape. They have tabled at a very wrong time when the fuel price, oil prices was shooting up the roof, and they tabled a proposal, which was accepted, by the way, to impose a surcharge on the fuel levy. And that was that. It still sits there because everybody noticed. And as you say, do we create tax room for that? And by the way, once you start creating tax room, we must still go back to those revenue sharing formulae and then begin to revise them to take into account of the fact that when you create tax room, the nationally collected pool must actually be reduced. And when it is reduced, we must then think about the tax room that we've created, how evenly is it distributed across the 9 provinces. And so we must then try and find a way or a mechanism to try and compensate those provinces that would not, even if we create tax rooms, so they lose twice, because they will lose from the overall pool available, and they also lose because of the nature of economic activity that is in their jurisdiction. So you have that kind of a problem that you have to deal with. But here, I think it's really, from the Commission's point of view, the process and the recommendations are there, and they have been there. We have been having some discussions with the Minister of Finance, the current one. The previous Minister of Finance also had opened some discussions, for example, around borrowing for big infrastructure projects. If we think about the Gautrain as a provincial, you look at it as a provincial project. You look at the big airport in KZN as a provincial project. You look at Kuha as a provincial project, and then you look at how you finance that. There is a reason to say, can we allow these provinces to actually go and borrow? But when you go and borrow and you don't tax, it means you're taking the softer option, because borrowing is postponing taxation. So the problem, I think, is bigger than simply allowing provinces sufficient room to raise their own revenue. It's really looking at the system and taking deliberate political decisions in terms of where we want our fiscal decentralization project, as it were, to go. That is the key issue that I think there we need to resolve before we can discuss. So the problem that we have of a vertical fiscal gap will always persist so long as the alignment between expenditure assignment on the one side and revenue raising assignments on the other is not resolved. It's a reflection of the discussions that took place that led to the kind of a system that we have. The other issue that I wanted to talk to before I hand over to my to the rest of the team, the issue of the poverty line. I think I'm going to give to Edgar from the National Treasury. He might have a better answer to that, because I think we moved backwards when we moved back to the 800 rand. This, by the way, was the FFC's original suggestion. That was way back in 97, if I'm not mistaken. So we went back after having gone forward. We went backwards. So that's really a decision that the Treasury might actually have an explanation for. On the I think the rest of these questions, basically the relevant presenters should be able to talk to. I think maybe Lydia, can you talk to the conditional grant issues, and then we'll go to Conrad, and then we end with you. Okay.
Thanks. Well, I'll start that by addressing the question around whether there are any plans to rectify the issue of staff and skills in the implementation of conditional grants. What usually happens is that if a conditional grant is introduced, what a department is required to submit a business plan in terms of how it is going to implement. So one would expect that in the business plan, the departments will have to indicate, for instance, if they will need additional staff, they will have to indicate in their business plan and also provide proper costing in terms of that. But what seems to happen is that most of the time, you know, the departments, they can sometimes they don't do proper costing in terms of how much will they need, especially if it's additional funds. I'll make an example with when there was a grant on the extension of the child support grant, when it was still a conditional grant. Of course, if one looks at when, for instance, you'll have to implement the grant, you'll have to look at the ratio of beneficiary to staff. Because at the end of the day, the more you extend the grant to children up to a certain age, the more you will need staff in provinces to be able to implement that. So also on the issue of skills, of course you will have to look at whether is there a need to train your staff in terms of, you know, the implementation of the new policy. So all of that, I would say, needs to be included in your business plan. You know, and of course that information will have to be submitted to Treasury, and Treasury will have to make sure that it's, you know, it looks at the figures and make sure that at least it's proper projection. And then linked to that, one of the honourable members asked a question on whether who should play an oversight role in terms of that. Well, I would say National Treasury also should play a role in terms of ensuring that there is funding for additional staff if it's required. And also, as I'm saying, they need to look at the business plans of the provinces. I would also indicate that even Parliament can actually look at that. For instance, when the provinces report to Parliament, especially if it's the implementation of the new grant, I mean, they will have to talk about their business plan. What is in their business plan? And of course, Parliament can ask those kinds of questions that, you know, do you include that issues around staff? You know, have you done costing? Are you confident with your figures? So I would say Parliament also can play a role in terms of influencing that. And then on the issue of the provinces reporting expenditure after transferring, after money has been transferred, and of course, the honourable member indicated that sometimes provinces don't spend the money. In terms of intervening, for instance, when provinces get the allocation for conditional grants, they are also required to provide their own cash flow projections in terms of this is how much, you know, they will be able to spend. That is different from your IYM, because your IYM will actually show your actual expenditure. But one needs to also compare the projected cash flow with their own actual expenditure. So I would say that, for instance, provincial departments should be able to monitor, looking at, you know, this is what the municipality has indicated that it will spend in this month. But if you look at, you know, the way spending is happening, of course, one would be able to see that there is something happening there, and one would intervene to find out why are you spending less than what you projected in your cash flow. So I think somehow that's a mechanism that can be used, you know, to ensure that the money is spent on conditional grants. Of course, also there is an issue of the fact that provinces don't have, let me say, there is no framework for the assessment of this conditional grant. And one would ask the question of, if there isn't a framework, why should a national department transfer money, you know, to provinces? especially if they are not spending money on that particular conditional grant. And then there was also a question on the spillovers and externalities. I think I was referring to spillovers resulting from services provided by subnational governments, for instance, to support capacity building, structural adjustment, capacity building and structural adjustment with, let's say, the recipient administration. I think I've covered so far.
Let me just add a different dimension to the issue of spillovers, which links to a discussion that came up in the morning. What happens is that there are certain services that are provided only by certain provinces, that are only available in certain provinces. For example, your tertiary health facilities and therefore services, you also they are not available in all provinces. So those provinces that provide those, in terms of the revenue allocation formula, you don't actually directly cater for that. Now, because our formula are so people-driven, it's all demographically driven, what you then find is that when people from Mpumalanga, for example, must go to Gauteng, or from Northern Cape must come to the Western Cape for particular types of healthcare services, you have to compensate them. You can say, you might want to say, no, let's do a cross border billing, but the billing system have to have a foundation. Why must you bill the Northern Cape when you did not actually allocate the money for those kinds of healthcare facilities? So your conditional grants will be there so long as you have that disparities in the availability of different types of services. There are those where you just talk about public health infrastructure, that's your medical aid, non-medical aid problem. So it's public hospitals, so each province has. And at that level, one would expect that cross billing across, so you bill the people for services that are available in their province. But those services that are not available, obviously, it's a spillover into the other province, because the allocation that province gets is on the same basis as the other one. Now, you need to compensate those problems, those conditions once they become available. So a typical example of that kind of a grant would be your NTSG, for example, your National Tertiary Services Grant, your Health Profession Training and Development Grant. Those are typical examples of grants that try to deal with spillovers. They are not transitional, so you would expect those, so long as you don't build tertiary facilities in Limpopo or in Mpumalanga, you would expect those grants to always persist.
I just want to draw members' attention to page 94 of the Division of Revenue, where the conditions are clearly set out, the frameworks for conditional grants to provinces. In schedules 4, 5, and 8. So it is, and that's what we dealt with last week, or the week before that, next week when we deal with the negotiating mandates, or tomorrow and the final mandates. Treasury, you want to come in?
Thank you, Chair. On the, just to add on the question with respect to funds that are transferred from conditional grants to provinces to municipalities and then reflected as spent when in fact they had merely transferred the funds. This is has been a problem for some time, particularly with a grant such as the Community Libraries Grant. As you know, the Constitution assigns the library's function to provinces, but in a number of places, particularly where there's metropolitan municipalities, the libraries actually run by the municipalities. And the province is not really in a position to do that. So then the funds would then be transferred. Of course, there's also the human settlements grant where some municipalities are credited to provide or to build houses. We have had engagements with this with provinces and provincial treasuries. We've recommended a number of things. One of the things that we've recommended that provinces
should do. And in fact, if you look at the framework for the conditional grant of the community libraries, it does make provision for agreements or service level agreements to be entered into between municipalities and provinces, outlining how various issues around the transfer should be dealt with. In addition to that, I believe it's section 15 of the new bill outlines the process according to which the transferring officer in a province moving money to a municipality can include certain requirements in a gazette that municipality must meet. What we've advised, one of the things we've advised provinces to do is, in, as part of their agreements with municipalities, arrangements with municipalities, that in that last, especially in that last 3 months where there's an overlap between the financial year and the municipal financial year, that some sort of cash flow arrangement be made to establish exactly what the requirement would be for the library in terms of the payment of salaries or the recapitalization or whatever. And then to be able to match that with what needs to be transferred. In addition to that, we've also said that because it's a national conditional grant, the stipulation that the funds must be returned if they're unspent must remain. So the province must make sure that in its arrangement with the municipality that is very clearly laid out.
Mr. Mali, you may proceed with the responses.
To respond to the budget.
With respect to Honourable, is it Mashele? The first point on the conclusion, I presume the question related to government revenue tends to be pro-cyclical and at municipal level may even exaggerate the business cycle. In this instance, where the government is part of the economy, if the government spending is growing faster than the economy, it will tend to accelerate growth, and if it is cutting back its spending faster than the economy is declining, it will also tend to push growth down. So if government is spending more or spending less than the growth of the economy, it can make the cycle more pronounced, whereas the intention is to make the cycle less pronounced. But it is possible for the government to make it more pronounced, particularly in the case of municipal governments, which spend a lot of money on capital, and it's that portion of spending that's been going doing this type of process. There was a question on fiscal dumping and what can we do to intervene, or at least this is where money get passed on to a lower level of government or to an NGO or to a service delivery agent at the end of the year. I would imagine there's two things. I mean, I'm certainly aware that the Treasury is aware of it, and they have specified in the budget format to whom transfers go to. What the committee should probably do is investigate the transfers more closely during its in-year monitoring. So, for example, if it's particularly noticeable at the end of the year, we know that fiscal dumping is happening. The other thing would be to require anyone who receives government money to report on what they are delivering. But that's part of a broader solution to that issue. But I think honing in on the transfers at the end of the year, or honing in during the in-year monitoring would be one possible solution. There was a further question about the Money Bills Amendment Act and how Parliament might streamline the budget process. What we noticed in particular, particularly when we were analysing the parliamentary schedule against the budget process, was that there's a particular sticking point round about the adjustment budget and the medium-term budget policy statement, where I think the Money Bills Amendment Act gives 2 months or something to comment on it, and there really isn't that time between the MTBPS and the Division of Revenue Bill. There's also a period round about April, May, when it starts getting a bit clogged, where if the Parliament is amending the Act it pushes, puts too much pressure on the treasuries to respond. So there may be some, there seem to be two places at the end of the year and round about just before the middle of the year where it seems to be quite clogged. There was then a question on what are the linkages between the equitable share and the conditional grant. Here we were talking specifically about capital grants, such as the municipal infrastructure grant and the housing grant. The LES has a basic services component, which has a per household amount for water, for electricity, for sanitation, and so on. But the houses, the municipal infrastructure grant is not separate, well, it's only recently been separated between a bulk grant and a reticulated grant. In other words, there isn't a link between a capital grant, which gives a house water, electricity, or road access, and the maintenance operating grants, which are covered in the equitable share, which follow up on that. So there's a disjuncture between what the capital grants are providing and what are the operational implications of that. And the same, in a sense, applies to the infrastructure grant to provinces and the provincial equitable share, where we're talking about the school and being constructed, but the implications and maintenance are covered in the program, which is financed by the equitable share. So those are the kind of examples that we're talking about. There was a further question relating to policies that aren't necessarily followed up. Has the FSC noticed this, and is it a problem? I think the general comment is that it takes about 2 to 3 years to implement a policy change. So it might be a year or so, before it's reflected in a budget, and in 2 years or so before it's reflected in spending and implementation and delivery stats. But I think there's, for example, in the budget review, there's a proposal for a grant to employers to employ the youth, an internship program. It's not clear. I'm guessing that it's the Department of Labor that would do it, but I don't think it's clear in the budget. A question on the provincial owned revenue and national government would have to let something go. The early FSC recommendations were that a portion of personal income tax go to provinces, and at the time that was rejected by the Treasury and by SARS. Whether we could revive that or not, but that's the only constitutional option. Provinces generating deficits, and what is the history and what are the national interventions? I'd like to pass that question on to Yolinda, but there is a history of it. In 1996-97, the provinces were overspending, again on education and health. And there is an intervention through the PFMA, and I can't remember the section, but it does entitle national province to basically take over the provincial government's finances, section 100 intervention, yeah. And it did work before. So, yes, there are those facilities. Now, the contradiction about the shock absorber role, I was intending it to mean that in as much as subnational, provincial and municipal governments are there to provide basic services, those are, relatively speaking, follow a more stable growth path. And so they are absorbed from the shock of a cutback in revenue. It's capital spending that is the opposite of a shock. But if we were to see government as being responsible for capital spending, then that point is taken. It would be the opposite of a shock absorber. So it's a relative term. And then there was a question of clarification about the personnel share increasing for local governments despite wage restraint. And yes, I agree that sentence is a bit complex. The wage restraint means referring to municipalities budgeting for relatively low increase in wages compared to provinces and national. So I think the wage increase is 3% in real terms versus 9 or 10%. But nevertheless, personnel spending is still growing faster than the average for municipal spending, which is why its share is rising. But its share is rising very, very slowly. So it's like 24.8 to 25.1. It probably wasn't worth mentioning, actually. But it's just to point out that municipalities that seem to be budgeting for wage restraint versus the national and provincial, particularly the provincial sphere, where it's not happening. Savings are savings just rebranding underspending? Underspending, I'm guessing, is unplanned by the department, whereas savings would be planned. And I think if I'd ask you, Linda, to clarify a bit more, but savings, I think, are about cutting back on unnecessary, more like admin costs and transport and conferences and so on, rather than looking at the actual basic spending on teaching materials or road building and so on. If a capital project is not spent, then that would be, well, it depends. If it's been planned, it would go over, and there's a rollover. If it's unplanned, then it's underspending.
I think, thank you, Chair. Two issues, just about the over expenditure and whether the deficits and why it's necessary for provinces to have savings in the statement that was in the FFC's presentation. I think last year, 2008 and 9, was a particularly difficult year. Because we had 5.8 billion in over expenditure, 10 billion accumulated unauthorized expenditure, and 5 billion accrual. So what we do see is an attempt by provinces to recover from those deficits. And so it's necessary to have or to table surplus budgets. So that would explain the the statement made by the FFC, if that is what Conrad wanted to convey to the committee. So it is necessary for provinces actually to have that surplus because of the problems of the past. Currently what we do is, in terms of Section 100, the Constitution does provide for an intervention. That intervention can be in terms of the monitoring as well as technical support. What we're currently doing is that we are assisting several provincial treasuries on their own are doing work in terms of assisting provincial departments where there's been overspending and accumulated unauthorized expenditure. But that is basically just in support in terms of the technical assistance. But it's then necessary for the department and the province to generate the savings. And that would mean to cut back on the non-essential spending items. Then, Conrad, was there something else? No, I think that I'm okay with that one. There was nothing else. Thanks. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Marlon.
Okay, thank you. Just to start, just to add on one of Conrad's points about linking the LES with MIG, I think he stated very nice the conceptual to it, but currently in the formula, you do have, like I said, a full subsidy for service households versus a partial subsidy for unserviced households. So that was the initial link to the MIG. So what will happen is the more services that, or the more households that are connected to new infrastructure would have then been popped up, their services would have been, the subsidy would have just been popped up in the local government equitable share to fund the additional operating costs. But the problem you have with that is that the data issue, the data is not updated. We're still using 2001. So any progress made with spending in the municipal infrastructure grant from 2001 to date has not been factored into LES. But just to add on to his point. The first point I have is the one with income. What I can do is just give my take on it, and then maybe National Treasury can add. Like Mr. Kumalo said, we did take a step backwards by reverting to income. The reason for that is that the current structure of the formula requires poor households to be differentiated between those with access to services versus those without access to services. So using imputed expenditure, currently or at the time, there was no way to get that distinction. Therefore, National Treasury went back to using income. The point is taken that, I mean, we all know using RAN 800 per month is going to disadvantage quite a few people, but the good thing, in a bad way, you can say, is that since the formula, the data is not updated, People earning 800 in 2001 are still, even though we know that their income has increased with inflation, so now they earn, with the social grants, so now they're earning 1,002. Because the data is not updated, they still covered currently in the formula. But, I mean, the problem comes in when they have to update it with maybe the 2011 census, and then there has to be a review of the poverty measure. Currently, I know Statistics South Africa are busy on something to try to measure or get better measurements of poverty. I don't know, do you want to add?
Jay, I think that's accurate. Just that put another way, that obviously if you increase that income level without changing anything else in the formula, which we actually have tested, it actually creates very severe distortion. So you don't want to change that income measure in the absence of a more comprehensive review of the overall formula.
Okay, thanks. The next question was on district municipalities. I just want to apologize for not being very explicit in the way I stated or the way the presentation stated districts without powers and functions. Without powers and functions with regards to the four major services, as in electricity, water, refuse, and sanitation. So they do spend, or they do have powers and functions with regards to, like, for example, regional economic development and firefighting services, etc. But I still feel that's a very, very good point made. Currently, I mean, the last time I heard, National Treasury were busy with a review of the funding mechanism to district municipalities, given that some have more powers and functions versus the others. And especially with the abolishment of the RDC levies and the replacement with a grant, what you have is that the district municipalities, which was termed as no powers and functions or limited expenditure responsibilities, are getting quite a lot of money from the grant. So that's currently in review. Maybe Treasury again can add there, but that's a very good point made. On the point on why there's a large fall in the sanitation for rural municipalities, the backlog data used in the formula is based from 2001 census. And what you have is that in 2001, a large amount of rural municipalities, they didn't have households connected to sanitation. So they would have got a partial subsidy versus the higher amount of connection they had for electricity or for water. So therefore, that's the large fall in that component. The point on the fuel levy and its impact on the RRC component and the LES, that again is a very good point, because the amount of funds raised from the RRC levy for especially the six metros was very fast. And when the fuel levy was introduced, which is based on fuel sales, there was a huge shock into the system. So what National Treasury did was to phase in the shock, so it wouldn't be, it was phasing within 3 years. So this was also applied to the LES, so there wasn't any major shift in allocations, because the fuel levy in the LES was was also phased in the way the actual fuel levy was phased in. The role of urban municipalities in development, I can speak very generally on this, and maybe Mr. Kumar can come in, but if you look at it, over 60% of the economy or fabric of the economy is based in six metros. If you take the 21 secondary cities, you'll have 27 municipalities that have over 80% of the country's GDP. So, the role that these cities play in our macroeconomic development is very important. So the way, the level at which they grow will obviously affect our economy in general. So, the things they can do is, like, for example, investment in economic infrastructure, and also, as municipalities provide the services and other social needs to foster private investment and foster the economy as a whole. The issues we face with now is how should we fund that, or how do we fund that? Currently, that's been funded by the metro's borrowing capacity, for example, capital investment in infrastructure, etc. So the issue there is, it should be, or must be, or can we fund it to foster general economic development in the country, but maybe Mr. Kumar can continue that. The contradiction of stating that you have a certain amount of funds for electricity, for water, for sanitation, but then the national government is not able to say, okay, you must spend it because of the unconstitutionality of the grant is a problem that is very hard to balance. In specific to the LEF or local government, what National Treasury did from 2009 was to specify the exact amount for each function, and therefore kind of guide the actual allocation and how much needs to be funded for each service. But like we all know, it's unconstitutional, so they don't have to follow that. But I don't know of any further developments on it. I think that's it. If anyone wants to add.
Edgar, last words, and then Mr. Kumalo.
Yes, no, just to say that I think Chugal meant to say it's unconditional, not unconstitutional. So in other words, even though you can stipulate certain guidelines in terms of the basic services, it's an unconditional allocation to municipalities. And I suppose if you think about it as well, the differences in municipalities is such that if you get one municipality that is, as Mr. Kumalo stated earlier, 90% funded by the equitable share versus another one that's, let's say, 30% funded by equitable share. In other words, it's got a huge portion of its own revenue. Then the way that it actually finances its activity might actually be different because of the internal flexibility. Thank you.
Mr. Kumalo?
I think just the only thing that I can add to what Jugal says, I mean, the discussion around how we deal with our urban environments and our big cities. We have adopted in the beginning a very naive approach to the funding of our local governments here by treating everybody as if they are the same. And it basically is very clear now that the metros, the needs of the metros and the big cities are closely linked to the hopes and aspirations and the prospects for the country as a whole. So there's a need to focus energy and effort on trying to uplift our rural and small towns, but in a very different and deliberate way, also to try and shift the focus and incentives and get the right incentives for our cities and our metros to behave in a particular way. I think we probably are all aware of the big problems that big cities are actually faced with. For example, now with respect to water and sanitation, I mean, it's all in the papers. Underground infrastructure for the big cities, you sometimes get scared when you hear that somebody was driving somewhere in a Bedford View and then the whole freeway just collapsed because underneath there's somebody who was trying to fix something and there's there's underground, they don't know about it. So those are issues that we think probably necessitate a different approach to the funding and funding instruments and mechanisms that we take for the smaller rural kind of areas, because there are priorities to do with that. But it's highly unlikely that there will be a reversal of migration of people, for example, from the cities to the rural municipalities. And also, it's highly unlikely that some of the small rural municipalities will ever be able. I'm sure members that I accompanied to the Northern Cape, we probably have an idea of what is happening in some of those. I mean, there is absolutely no way one can expect that some of those will be able to stand on their own. So that's a typical grant case. Now, do you apply the same kind of rules to those kinds of small municipalities that you apply to a municipality like Johannesburg or Etowin? So it's like the thinking, it's at the brainstorming or whatever stage at this point in time, but there's definitely a need to refocus the way in which we do things around those, I think, yeah.
Mr. Marlon, thank you for you and your team, all the members. We believe that this was a very informative session. Again, I want to apologize to the FFC that the day was shortened, but we could do nothing about it. Joint sitting was arranged, and we had to amend our program. Thank you for you and your team for coming and briefing us, also the Treasury that made their inputs. Thank you for the province's attendance, that they took the time off to come to Cape Town to come and listen, and this will be the trend. When we deal with issues that we think focus specific on you, and the NCP does, we will invite you to get a closer relationship with the provinces, the chairpersons, etc., but also with the FFC. And as indicated, when we do oversight in provinces, we will invite the FFC to come and accompany us if it's possible. We also get receive the picture of what to focus on when we do our oversight. Referring to the spending on conditional grants by municipalities, but also by the different departments in provinces. And then another issue addressed on page 5 of the proposals from the FFC on the Division of Revenue is to look at, and that's also on our table, to the intergovernmental fiscal relations system. That coordination between the different spheres of government, but also in departments regarding the budget process. That is very important to get the services we want to be delivered outside to our people. Honourable members, we've got 19 minutes to get to the joint sitting. For those from provinces, I don't know if you've got tickets to attend in the gallery, but you're then welcome. This meeting then stands adjourned. Thank you, and those who drive safely. Honourable members,
I've been waiting many years to attend a meeting like this, and knowing you for many years, coming from the same place.